Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, November 26, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389-pound. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more on our donation tab on the top right. Tonight's scripture reading, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. It's in the Gospel of John. We're in chapter 8, verses 48 through 59. So chapter 8, verses 48 through 59. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, Say we not well that thou art a Samaritan and hast a devil? Jesus answered, I have not a devil, but I honor my Father, and ye do dishonor me. And I seek not mine own glory, there is one that seeketh and judgeth. Truly, truly, I say unto you, if a man keep my saying, he shall never see death. Then said the Jews unto him, Now we know that thou hast the devil. Abraham is dead, and the prophets, and thou sayest, If a man keep my sayings, he shall never taste of death. Art thou greater than our father Abraham, which is dead, and the prophets are dead? Whom makest thou thyself? Jesus answered, If I honor myself, my honor is nothing. It is my Father that honoreth me, of whom ye say that he is your God. Yet ye have not known him, but I know him. And if I should say, I know him not, I shall be a liar, like unto you. But I know him, and keep his saying. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it, and was glad. And then said the Jews unto him, Thou art yet 50 years old, and thou hast, and hast thou seen Abraham? Jesus said unto them, Truly, truly, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. Then took they up stones to cast at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. John chapter 8, verses 48 through 59. And we'll pick up there next week. Okay, I guess one of the main things we want to bring up tonight before we get started is, of course, that the course is open. We talked about that last week. I just want to make note to everyone. If anyone's having any problems with that course, to make contact with us as soon as possible. Jen, is there any information up there for anyone to get a hold of, call, or who would they contact with any problems on this? I know Catherine was taking care of the other courses.
I think the written material on the website says contact Carl.
Okay.
But he should be the one that could answer the questions now.
So as they enter into the course, there's that information available there?
Yeah.
Correct?
It is. Yes,
okay.
It is.
All right. Let's see. So anyway, we did open the course. It is extremely important that anybody that is an administrator that they should definitely be taking this course. Anybody who is planning to be an administrator, a jury administrator, you know, cannot come one unless you take this course. When positions open up, then those who are completed the course will have first, you know, dibs, I guess I'd say, concerning what county they're working in. And there's only 4 positions per county. And if they're not finished the course, depending on others who haven't finished the course, whoever is further along will get the first option to take the positions within their county. Now, of course, you can work in another county. Some people might want to work in another county. And so maybe it's closer to them, to their home, by going into another county in opposed to their own county. So anyway, you do not have to live in the county that you work in to hold these positions. Now, anybody that is already donating on a monthly basis, okay, would be able to get direct access right into the course. Anybody who is not donating, we're requesting $5 a month or more donating for, you know, a period of the next 2 years at $60 a year. That's one cup of coffee and a roll of butter or a donut or something a month that you give up. So it's not really asking too much. But, you know, when you put this collectively together, we get enough people, it's a considerable amount of money that will help pay the bills and, you know, allow us to do a lot of other new things that we'd love to do, but we don't have the money to do. let's see. Also, anybody who is donating, there are a few people, probably, I don't know, maybe half a dozen or more, that have been very constant in sending in donations by mail monthly. And those people, in order to get access, just get a hold of Dan, and he'll kind of flip the switch for you. Have you worked that out with Carl yet, some kind of a switching system, Jan?
Yes, that's all taken care of. All I have to do is contact me and let me know the circumstances, and I can turn them on instantly.
All right. I see you had a conversation with Carl. I missed the call. So
right.
All of the problems or situations we spoke about is already under control?
As many as can be resolved without major overhaul are done. So we should be in good shape.
All right. Well, I'll get into the details with you tomorrow. Give me a call in the morning or something. We'll go through it. So anybody, again, who is, sending in money and wants to get into the course, just get a hold of Jan at National Liberty Alliance. You could drop him an email. What do you need? The username? What do you need in order to flip the switch? What's the best, easiest?
Well, the easiest is their email. Now, I've had some problems in that people apparently signed up with one email, and when they send me an email, they use a different one, and I can't find them in our members list, so I can't check on anything. So be sure.
So everybody make a note of that.
Yeah, be sure if you're sending me an email that you use the email that you signed up with on the NLA website on your account. That way I can check it out very quickly and get back to you.
Or write the email that you used in the, in the message, the text message, right?
Right. Or even the username should work too.
Now, we've had some people who sign up, and they've got an email program that requires an action in order to get the information out to them. I don't know. I guess those people, if they use that kind of an email to join, then they wouldn't have gotten the message to confirm, would they?
No.
Yeah, so I guess they never became members. Okay. Although we do get some that return back saying, oh, well, if you want to do this, you want to get this message through, because I've seen them, you know, you got to do this or do that.
Right.
So I don't know, maybe they changed over to some kind of a system or a service after joining, maybe. And I'm presuming that's the case. But you have to use an email that gives direct access so we can respond back. So those people who have that kind of email, they're not getting any mail that we're sending out. And this is an active group here. You know, we want to be proactive. We want to get as many people active as possible. You know, our purpose is ultimately to save the nation. You know, Donald Trump is doing a great job, and a lot of people working with him, and, you know, things may get really, really great, and things may look really, really good. But if the people don't step up and get educated and take control of consenting to their government and bringing the fear of the people into them, and require an obedience. If you're not going to do that, then we're only going to come back to where we started from and right back up to total destruction again. So it's up to the people to secure liberty by requiring the government to obey the Constitution. It's that simple, by the way. It doesn't get any more difficult than that. If everyone doing their job is just obeying the Constitution, and we monitor that and make sure that happens, that is all that is necessary to maintain just courts, to maintain a just nation, and to have a true liberty. But unless that happens, there's not going to be, you're not going to have true liberty. We the people do not have true liberty. We just don't have it. Many of our constitutional rights, if you want to call them that, unalienable rights protected by the Constitution is a better way of saying that, are just totally ignored. If not all of them, all of them. It gets depressing sometimes when you sit down and look through these things and discover the resistance you get, especially in the courts by these people in black robes. I mean, it's just disgusting in my opinion. But, you know, anyway, okay, let's see. So this government by consent course, again, anybody who wants to take it, if you can't afford $5, there are some people that are on a really very low limited income and they just can't afford $5 a month. Maybe they can afford maybe occasionally to give $5 a month or whatever, it doesn't matter, but they can't afford it. They can get a hold of Jan and Jan will flip the switch to give you access into the course. Let's see what else here. Oh, yeah, the government by consent course is getting really an in-depth study and focus on our founding documents and also the Magna Carta. So we'll be looking very, very deeply into the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Capstone Bill of Rights, but we'll also be looking into the Magna Carta in this consent course, government by consent course. Which again, you know, I'm writing a book and it'll pretty much be a lot of what's in the course and there'll be extra stuff, but basically, you know, a lot of stuff that's in this course will be available in the book. The name of the book is, I think is going to be called Liberty Lost. I'm kind of set on that at the moment, so. And, of course, by getting that book, Liberty Found. But anyway, you know, you can't have liberty if you're ignorant to what it is. And if you're ignorant to the process by which we have consent to our government. So also, I think we're going to be closing down the Constitution course because this government by consent course is a far superior course that's going to, you know, cover all of that that's in the constitutional course and in a much deeper and greater, you know, depth. You know, that course was put together rather quickly some time ago, and, you know, I've always wanted to go back and redo it and get more deeper. There are a few errors, I think, if I recall some of the thoughts that I had back then when we put it together, that need to be corrected. Nothing major, but we need to correct error wherever we can find it. And that certainly will be corrected in this course. And once this course is up and going, if we do discover error, if anybody notifies us of some error, you know, we'll make those corrections. And of course, you know, this will all work out better for us as we prepare to go forward to get the book published. I'd love to say, and I think I mentioned this before, we're targeting to have the book going to publishing by Christmas. Now, I don't know much about publishing. I know that we can do, I think it's through Amazon or through a few places. Maybe it's Google. I don't remember where. I think Google. But there may be Amazon and a few other places that, matter of fact, I know that Amazon does it. We can do some publishing where they print books as needed. It'll raise the cost of the book if we go that route, but it can be done that way. One way or the other, we will get this published. I've got a couple of publishers that I'm going to approach, and I think one particularly might be very interested in the type of book that we have because that's the type of books that they publish. And as a matter of fact, that's all the kind of books that they publish. So, you know, we're looking for true freedom, so we may even be radical to some people who don't really have a real good, deep understanding of what liberty really is. And but in any event, you know, hopefully by Christmas, around Christmas, which is only 3-4 weeks away, we'll be in a position, or maybe the beginning of the year, in a position to be able to push towards publishing and getting that out there. all right. Anyway, we're going to be shutting down the constitutional course. We're probably just going to flip it. You know, I know we can shut it down and prevent anyone else from taking it. Anyone that's already taking the course, they can continue in that course. So we won't completely shut it down. But we'll probably block people from entering it, and therefore they'll enter for the constitutional course. They'll enter into government by consent course, which, again, far, far deeper. And there's so much subject matter we're covering around the Constitution under particularly common law and getting into the study of the different courts available and what are lawful courts in this nation, in our country, and how this whole thing was put together as far as law is concerned and equity is concerned, how the courts have been put together and what kind of abuses that are just common in the courts. And, you know, we're dealing with a lot of those things. We're going to put together a way to access courts of record, which is a court, that proceeds according to natural law or common law. Someone dropped me a line recently, and I forget where it was. Maybe it could have been a hard copy letter or something. But they asked the question, well, which common law, are you talking about? Hopefully they'll come to our Monday night programs and they'll understand which common law. But in any event, maybe we don't bring it up often enough. There is two different common laws. There's the true common law that we understand is defined as the old English law that when this nation was created, that we were taken on that common law, which is also referred to as natural law. And so that's the common law we're looking at. In this nation, in order to cover up common law, in order to cover up courts, they did a couple of things. They created what was called criminal courts and civil law courts. And they put them all under equity. And that's pretty clear to me. And they might allow you, they just might, allow you to have a jury, It'd be nice. But in any event, that's a cover-up. They've totally hidden. There's no access to a court of record at all. If you would ask the clerk, they'd look at you like you got six eyes. If you were to search out some kind of other form to fill out other than the civil court form that they give you, which is statutory and they require or push you towards a statutory reason for the going into that court, especially on the federal level, of course. Again, it's just concealed. So we have an idea we're going to be experimenting with soon, and we will be putting that idea into the book and onto our website so other people can copy that idea and, with their cases also. They have robbed us of our heritage. They have robbed us of natural law. They have robbed us of our courts, our natural law courts, and they've covered it up. And so the common law that they claim, and I've been hearing this from lawyers for a while, and I realize, wow, this is what they're looking at as common law. They look at common law as a collection of all court cases, let's say on the federal level. They'll look at any federal district conclusion or, whatever the decision is. And these guys just make law right there, and then all of a sudden it becomes part of their common law. Well, that's no common law at all. That's common equity to begin with, but it's all unlawful because they're not to operate under the opinions and thoughts and ideas of each other. They are to be operating under American jurisprudence, and they don't. And why the United States Supreme Court doesn't do anything about this, they're just as guilty as anyone else. They know what's going on, and yet they have done nothing to solve this problem. Congress knows what's going on. Well, maybe Congress is pretty dumb, so maybe they don't know. But certainly these federal judges know. Certainly the United States Supreme Court knows. When we listen to these, judges being interviewed by Congress to become United States Supreme Court justices. You listen to Kavanaugh recently and others in the past, they know. They understand exactly. They know how law is put together, how it's constructed. They understand all of the U.S. titles. They know that law is courts of record and equity is positive law courts, which really positive law is human-made law. In our case, under the authority of the Constitution, specifically and particularly Article 1, Section 8. But there are other places in the Constitution that does give some authority for to write some law. And so they know. They can't not know, okay? And they still don't do anything about it. Now, we could say, well, they've had guns to their heads for a long time. Well, Trump's up there. There are other people up there. It's time to do something now. It's time to open up the courts of justice, the courts that belong to the people. So anyway, of course, that's what our court case is going to be all about. And hopefully we'll get people to spread this copy of this case once we get it written up and out there. We are working on it. We have been working on it. And again, I've been working on that also with the course and the book because they all work together. And I'm trying to focus in on particular subject matter studies that has something to do with our court case has been up forward, although we did get out the first, I think, 5 or 6 chapters. And we have other chapters to follow up, of course. Again, we're not sure how many chapters it's going to be, 12 to 15 chapters in the course, don't know. But it's going to be a pretty lengthy course, pretty in-depth course. Guaranteed, when you get through it, you will understand the system. You will understand how things work, what the structure of the courts are, what is law, what is equity, how this all came to be, and where the enemy is. Because once you see the truth, it becomes obvious who are the gatekeepers to prevent the truth from going forward and for the people to have true courts of justice. Okay, anyway, it's a course that everyone should really take. And it'll also, and again, you know, someone asked me, well, why, how come we're charging for this? And I don't want to say we're not really charging. We're asking for support. And people, we need to have support, financial support, that is. $5 a month is not a lot. And we make everything we can do to get people into the course that can't afford to pay for that course, they're going to get in. So we're not going to deny anyone. But $5 a month is not much to ask for to help support the work that we're doing here and pay the bills, keep the lights on, get papers written and papers out. And at some point, when we get into power and authority where the people belong again, we'll have a whole new structure. It'll pretty much be what we have, but an added kind of a structure to what we're doing that will yield a lot of money, and therefore we'll have positions that will be paid positions here at National Liberty Alliance. But until we get that kind of a structure and get that kind of income, of course, everything is voluntary. But we really do need paid positions. We need people who are putting 8 hours a day, 5 days a week into this, working on research or working here and working there. Doing different things in order to get the things out that we need. Also, we'll be very, very deeply involved in teaching people the true political process and the positions that people are voting for. Well, what exactly is their job? Who are they? What does this person do? What does that person do? What positions are appointed and who appoints them? So if you got bad people in positions that's been appointed, well, you can go and find out who appointed them and start to rock their boat, so to speak. If you become a committeeman, that'll be a very powerful tool to have, to make a phone call, for the committeeman to make a phone call to that individual who they got onto the ballot and walked their papers within their districts to get them elected, and not necessarily struggling to get this one or that one elected. I really think committeemen, if you go back and read George Washington's farewell address, understand that at least 3/4 of that address was focused towards the political problem, particularly dealing with the committeemen, committees of safety that morphed into committeemen, and he talked about the problems, and so people should read that to come to an understanding. There should be no politics, if I may use that word, to make the difference between the political process and the BS that goes on, the lies, the deceit, anything. They'll say anything in order to get money and get elected. That we need to get rid of. As long as we have politics, we will have those things. In our political process, there is no need for politics. None whatsoever. We just need statesmen. There should not be, this idea or that idea over another individual. I mean, of course, people come up with, backgrounds and positions and ideas, and you vote for them. But what I'm talking about is where we send people to Washington, maybe, and then they go in to these people, these special interest groups, and they get all this funny money, and they now do the will of corporate America instead of the will of the people. Well, first of all, that should be illegal. Well, that's a crime, in my opinion, a strong opinion, and I think I could build a case easily on this. It's called bribery. They were sent there to do a job to represent the people of their districts, not to represent corporate America in order to get all that funny money. excuse me. So that's a crime, and it's a problem, and that's politics. Politics is dirty. They're not doing the job they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be statesmen. And if they're paying it, if they really understand the Constitution and obeying the Constitution and using it as a guideline, there is no room for opinion. There's the Constitution. There's only room for the will of the people, we the people, ordained and established. This Constitution for these purposes, and there are six purposes. We read about them, of course, in the preamble to the Constitution. And so, matter of fact, maybe we'll just take a quick look at that, because it's extremely important. If any action, anyone, anywhere in government authority, at any level, is not fulfilling one or more of the purposes of these six points, then they're not doing their job, and they're only destroying America. They're not helping it. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, that was number one, this is the purpose of this whole thing, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. They've destroyed our justice. We can't get into court. There are no courts of justice. Can't be found anywhere. Only equity courts. That's all we got. Equity courts, that are brought together. There's a word. I can't think of the word where two different things come together and it becomes something on its own, but it's maybe it's quasi-something. I forget what it is. But anyway, they have taken a statutory process and applied it to natural law. That's controlling the will of God. That is trying to control God. They're trying to control justice. That's what that's all about. And this is what we have. We have courts of injustice. Establish justice. We failed there. Ensure domestic tranquility. Well, they're surely failing there when we look down to our borders and other places. Provide for the common defense. Promote the general welfare. Secure the blessings of liberty. Let me repeat that one. Our founding fathers understood that liberty was a blessing. Unless we were morally minded people, we could not possibly have liberty. It's an impossibility. And that's why liberty has been destroyed in this nation, because we've lost our way, and we've been demoralized. Of course, there's powers above, shall I say, the prince and power of the air, that has a lot of control on different things and has deceived us. Nevertheless, though, we read here to secure the blessings of liberty, okay, by being just, by obeying the Constitution, by obeying the true law of the land, natural law, to ourselves and our posterity, and do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. I heard Judge Napolitano talking about, I was kind of surprised the way his attitude was on this. But you didn't get involved in writing the Constitution. I know I was very, very surprised to find out, because I kind of like him and he's got a lot of good opinions, although I don't agree all the time with him. Recently he had an opinion that was against, I forget what it was, but something that Trump was doing. and I thought he was wrong, because there was other law that superseded that law that he was talking about. And maybe he just didn't realize that. But in any event, if we're going to go out and claim these things, we need to do our homework first. But his position is that it shouldn't have been we the people. It should have been we the states. Nothing could be further from the truth of this. It must be we the people. It could never be we the states. Now, the states have power and authority and are supposed to be sovereign. Although they've lost their power, they've lost their authority, and they lost their sovereignty. They have none of it. As soon as the 17th Amendment took effect, they lost all power and authority, any claim, any thoughts, anything, any concern, any opinion of whatever the federal government does means nothing to them because they have no power or authority to do anything. They took away the Senate, and they gave it to the people. We didn't even understand anyway. They already had representation. Anyway, he thought it should have been we the states and not we the people. That would have destroyed everything we are and everything we do. It was indeed we the people. It is true that those people who put this together, who formed committees of safety and took control of their government, were the people. It is true that they became elected individuals. Some of them became presidents. We have Jefferson and Washington. Adams, we have a lot of them that became president, and others that ran for office. As a matter of fact, before the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson was on a legislature in Virginia, served, I think, twice before, maybe once before the Declaration of Independence, and again after. He also served as governor, okay? So these people were active, and they did become, people who took power and authority in political positions. But they were we the people. They came together to create a new nation and an experiment. And the experiment was to have liberty, biblical liberty, true liberty, total freedom from all law, period. That's what liberty is, freedom from all law except the law of God. Thou shalt not kill, don't murder, don't steal. Other than those laws, there are no laws. I mean, there's more laws than killing and murdering, of course. I mean, murdering and stealing, of course, in common law. And whenever there's an injury, must be a remedy. Was that injury a criminal act or an accident? Either way, the person who did the injury is responsible. So that's what common law is all about. And it gets right down to the nuts and bolts. It doesn't get into the BS with making law mean this or twisting law to mean that, creating loopholes for this. And justice is never served, never, never served. These equity courts that are running civil courts and criminal courts, justice is never, ever served. Never. They have no concern to serve justice anyway. For them, it's all about control. All right, but anyway, so all these people were, politically involved people. They created a nation, and they did it for themselves and their posterity. And when the Declaration of Independence was written, the job was given to Jefferson and I think Adams. I forget which one. Maybe it wasn't Adams. Goodness, I forget who it was. But it ended up that Jefferson wrote it himself. But then it still had to go to committee and be approved. And then all of them came to an agreement. All of the colonies came to an agreement and voted on it and went forward with it. Same thing with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. It was a process of the people. And it makes sense, of course, that all these people involved probably came into political power and took positions in order to push forward this nation and keeping it focused on the Constitution and on justice. I mean, it doesn't make sense in any other way. So it's not politicians or political animals that wrote our Constitution. It wasn't the states, quote-unquote, that wrote the Constitution. It was the people in colonies came together to create states, came together to create a nation, came together to form a more perfect union which has justice in it. And justice starts in the courts. Our nation, if you want to know how serious a problem it is that this deep state is, look at the condition of our courts. Our nation will always reflect the justice of our courts or injustice of our courts. If people are getting away with murder in our courts, then the deep state is getting away with murder. We will reflect our justice system. That's who and what we are. Okay, So anyway, moving along, I forget where I was before we started talking about this, but I guess I've come to an end of things. I didn't really have a plan to really speak much today, but here we are 40 minutes in already. But other than that, I guess I have nothing more. Do we have any questions, Jan?
I did not receive any questions by email. I had a large number of questions by phone and email, but not to the questions box, and they were taken care of as they came up. In terms of announcements, we're still, as you know, John has mentioned this several times, we need grand jury administrators. We need a total of 13,000, and we need a lot of volunteers. We have come up with a couple volunteers for the Welcome Committee in the last 2 weeks. We could still use some more. We have a lot of work to do there. And we had a volunteer last week say that they were checking on arranging some interviews for John and Gerard, but I haven't heard anything more from them. And we are still looking for some more natural healing call people that would like to give a talk, or if someone you know that's into natural healing would like to give a talk, maybe 35 to 45 minutes with Q&A afterwards on a Thursday night at 8 Eastern, please send me an email, jan@nationallibertyalliance.org. And that's about all I have tonight, John.
Okay. And we don't have anyone else that wants to...
Not that I've heard from, no.
Okay. All right, I guess Gerard's not here yet, is he?
I haven't been looking for him.
I don't see him in here,
check.
No. Okay. I see Brent
here.
No, I
don't see him. Yeah.
All right, yeah, so I guess we'll move over to Brent if we have nothing else.
Right.
So we're going to pass the mic over to Brent, Brent Winters, the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent?
Thanks, John. I heard you hit the mute button on me when I came on. I was walking. You were probably listening to my feet. I'm walking down a main road in a small town out in the middle of nowhere, and I'm trying to get where it's quiet. These darn trucks probably overcut my voice a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about tonight originalism, originalism. Now, there are a lot of isms and schisms that would be better off if they wasn't, as they say, but originalism is not one of them. And originalism is the idea that when you approach a text of legal significance, such as a statute or the Constitution of the United States or your state constitution, that you approach it and ask yourself first and foremost the question, what was the original intent of those that enacted it? That's originalism. What did they mean by what they said at the time they said it? What did they mean by what they said at the time they said it? Now, when we're dealing with the Constitution of the United States, we're talking about something that was written over two centuries ago. And the question is, what did they mean at the time they said it? For instance, the First Amendment says that there shall be freedom of the press. Now, it's been my experience when one looks into that phrase, freedom of the press, he'll discover that what they meant at the time they said it was simply this, that anybody who wanted to own and operate a printing press could do it. That's exactly what they meant. They didn't have any way they could have been referring to computers or radio or television. Obviously, a television doesn't press anything. Neither does a radio. But you can't apply it in the modern times accurately unless you first understand what it meant, what was intended by its meaning, by those that first enacted it, freedom of the press. Well, once you've determined exactly what it meant when it was enacted, as best you can. Now, that's not always easy. In this particular instance I'm telling you about, just an example, it's pretty easy. Once you do that, then you ask yourself, okay, this case in front of me is about radio or television. How does that apply? And you see where you'd been, go way back, and then you see a line going forward and things growing out of it, such as radio and television. And you try to discern the first principle that applied then that should be applied now. Here's another one. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, arms is not referring to one's flesh and bone arm. It's referring to a weapon one carries using his arms. Before there were firearms, there were swords and spears, and those were called arms, and shields were called arms because it all had to do with offense and defense. But then when the First Amendment was put in place, we had firearms. Well, at the time that it was put into place, there wasn't anything available as for a firearm except a weapon that loaded from the muzzle, whether it be a pistol or a rifle or a musket. A rifle would have the rifling in the barrel, be the only difference, or a musket, all driven by today's standard, a slow-burning explosive, a powder, and there'd be a flint or a matchlock on it, and it would ignite fire in the pan, and that would go into the hole in the side of the firing train would begin. That'd go in the hole in the side of the rifle musket barrel, and that would turn that gunpowder in there instantaneously, almost, into gas that required a lot of room right away, enough to drive a projectile out the barrel. Well, that's what that applied to. Military-grade weapons like that, carried by an individual man. So some have said, well, today we have automatic weapons, fully automatic weapons, etc. Does it apply to those? And people said, yes, because the principle here is, even though the technology has become more precise and stronger, the principle is, what can a man carry in his hands? What can he tote on his back? Clearly a pistol is a carryable weapon, even though it's a six-shooter or a semi-automatic Browning or a semi-automatic Colt, 45 caliber, 9mm kind of a gun. So the idea there was that the word personal being key to the interpretation, the personal right to keep and carry a weapon. Well, the Heller decision looked at it just that away. They said, what we're going to decide here is whether Mr. Heller had a personal right to carry a pistol. And that's what that case was all about. And it was the first time the U.S. Supreme Court had considered that question in all of our 200 plus years. Of course, the reason being, the question had never come up before because nobody ever questioned the idea. And it's amazing today that we even questioned it, but we did. So the court landed on the right side. And they did so following the principle called originalism. Not strict constructionism, necessarily. No. Originalism. Strict constructionism has to do with parsing verbs like they were pieces of machinery. They're not. Strict constructionism isn't always that reasonable. Originalism is a reasonable way. Well, there's a difference between logic, which is reason, and that which is reasonable. I remember when I was in algebra class, we'd do our algebra problems, and then the teacher, Mrs. Johnson, said, now, stop and ask yourself, if there are no numbers in your equation bigger than 10, and your answer is 65 million, you know that that's unreasonable. And probably your answer isn't right. You need to go back and look again. So she taught us the first thing to do is just check for reasonableness, not reason. Now, reason is mathematically sure. Got to get out this road again. Reason is mathematically sure. That's logic. That's another word for logic, perfect balance. But reasonable is just what you get at first glance. Well, that looks reasonable. Well, that doesn't mean it's always right, but it's a good place to start. And when people look at the decisions of judges, the first thing the judge ought to want them to say to themselves is, well, that appears reasonable to start with. And that has to do with a good test for originalism. Now, if a person doesn't use the what is called today originalism to approach writings of legal significance, then he has no thing else to rely on. There is no other approach. I'm not exaggerating when I say that. If you don't hold to originalism, the moon is the limit. You can do anything you want. You can make anything up you want. And that's why some of the decisions the courts hand down, we look at them and say, that's wacky. Well, that's not reasonable. Well, the reason is, the logic of the other one is to see why, is because people that don't embrace originalism, which probably takes up at least 80% of the judiciary, they have no immediate goal when they go to interpret a text. If you're an originalist, you have an immediate goal when you go to interpret the text, and that immediate goal is, what did those that first enacted this intend it to say and to mean? If everyone, instead of 20% or less, if everyone on the court took that position, they still wouldn't all agree. But at least they'd be a lot closer and things would be more reasonable. And there was a time, not over 50 years ago, when originalism didn't even have a name because everybody practiced it across the board, and it didn't have a name because it was just the only sensible thing to do. And within the last 50 years, especially then through the late 70s forward, this whole idea that originalism is only dodos and people that aren't creative use that. Of course, you don't want people that are creative. You want people that are looking for what it really means and apply it correctly. But originalism was all there was, and it created a lot more stability because nearly every judge, approached the text of legal significance the same. And their disagreements were not over what it meant when it was originally enacted. Their disagreements are over finer points. And so the law and our interpretation of it, as the courts interpreted it on the appellate level, just kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And then with the advent of the late 70s, by the time we got to the late 70s, what had begun in the 60s had turned plumb crazier than a pack of bed bugs. And everyone decided that truth was what I believed it to be. Instead of being an objective thing, it became a subjective thing. If I believe it, it's true. And faith and belief became equated with truth. You know, how do you know the Bible's true, people began to say? Because I believe it. How do you know this over here is true? Well, because I believe it. That infuses it with truth. Well, it doesn't. That's ridiculous, of course. But that is the popular point of view today, not only in the courts, but in the churches, when it comes to the greatest writing of legal significance, which is the Bible, the revelation of God's will of the sovereign, his law, and he's the sovereign. Originalism, I first heard of it, I went to listen to Justice Scalia. That was way back in the 80s. I think he was appointed in 86. Reagan appointed him. And I remember when I went to the lecture, it was at a local Midwest university law school. When I say local, I mean the Midwest. I went to it. But amazingly, this is an old law school, but there wasn't. If you could have fired grape shot through the crowd, you wouldn't have hit too many because there wasn't much of a crowd there. Nobody even came to see it, hardly. And people were outside even at that time with signs. I remember one of the signs said something about scathing Scalia, as though he were a scather, and he was rough and undignified and tempered and on and on and on. Well, Justice Scalia, back in the mid-80s, I believe it was 86, he introduced back into the Supreme Court panel originalism, which had dominated it for 150, 175 years. Oh, 200 years, right at 200 years. And all of a sudden, zip, in 10 years, it was gone. And he brought it back. And he said that we should seek, every time we interpret a text, we should see how it applies. Interpretation, by the way, means how does it apply in this specific instance? Because every instance has a different set of facts. And so the same law, the same standard, has to be applied to that instance in a proper way. Now, the first principle of it has to be applied. But you can't find the first principle unless you first say, well, what did it mean by those folks that originally enacted it? You can take this principle of originalism. It is the only principle, by the way, of sound interpretation. The only one. There isn't anything else. I remember I said, and this is true historically, if you abandon originalism, there isn't anything else. It's just whatever you want it to be, and you just make it up as you go. I used to, and Justice Scalia made this point once, before originalism became unpopular in the late 70s and up into the 80s, judges only had one option. If they wanted a certain interpretation, they just had to lie about what it said, which is better because you can't get away with that too well. But judges used to do that. Well, this is what it didn't used to mean this. It used to mean this when it was first enacted. Well, if it's a lie, then they get what they want. But now you don't even have to lie. It's just too easy. You just say, well, I think that it should mean this because I believe in my heart of hearts that every time a drop of rain falls, a flower sprouts. Well, you may believe that. It doesn't make it true again. So everything should be looked at, number one, first, you parse the verbs, you do get mechanical, what do the words mean? But then you look at the intent of the framers, not to promote Abraham Lincoln. I don't want to do that for important reasons. But Abraham Lincoln understood this, and the thing that made him put him on the national scene was a speech he made in New York City at the Cooper Union speech. He'd never been out of the, what was then at that time, the wild, woolly, rough West. And when he got there, he was gangly and weird looking. His clothes didn't fit, and his body was disproportionate. And when he got up to speak, they expected a booming voice, and it was high and squeaky. That's the way his voice was. And the first thing he said when he stood up, as he said he liked to make a good ready, and, you know, hitch your pants, move your papers around, try to relax if you can. And then he said, Mr. Chairman, not Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, because out on the frontier, that's the way they said chairman. Well, that brought the house down in laughter just to start. That embarrassed him, but they liked it. But he went on during that speech, and he went through all of the votes of all of the men that signed the Constitution of the United States and later on the Bill of Rights, and he pointed out how all of them, in their votes in the state legislatures or anywhere they were, all of them supported the idea that slavery must be contained to the states it was already in. In other words, the point being, it couldn't go to Kansas, and that was a big fight in those days, whether Kansas would be free soil or not, the old common law doctrine of free soil. And Lincoln did that to show that what the original intent of the Constitution was concerning the containment of slavery. That was, his whole speech was about only that one thing. It focused on that, and that catapulted him into national prominence. He did his homework, did a good job. He did what everybody knew had to be done that nobody had done yet, or they hadn't heard anybody do it. And that established the original intent of the framers on that particular point. One more point I'll try to make. I'm walking up and down an alley now to get off the main road. One more point I'll try to make. It's a small town. There's really only one main street. It's not like it's dangerous in here. But when a fellow, for example, approaches the Bible, the same principle must apply. Otherwise, That's why you have, of course, people don't, they're not familiar with originalism. It means nothing to them. It's not part of their psyche. So when they approach the Bible, they do the same thing. What is, how many times have I been to Bible studies? Thousands of Bible studies. I like to say that when you go to a Bible study, you sit around somebody's kitchen table, usually what you get is just a pooling of ignorance. You know, people don't study it beforehand, and then it comes down to, well, what do you think it means? Oh, read it once. You've never read it before, but what do you think it means? Then each person says what they think it means. They don't have a clue what it means. They haven't looked at what possibly the writer could have meant by what he meant by what he said at the time he said it. What was the original intent? Now, if you look, a lot of times you can find that. Now, that's not always clear, but at least, again, when you approach a writing of legal significance, the more people that have this idea, the first thing we've got to do is find out, dig in, look at what's going on in the historic context, and find out what the original intent of those that wrote it was. Well, John, back to you. That's enough for originalism. I wanted to make sure that I got some kind of a definition on. Oh, one more thing. There for a long time, were only two originalists in recent times on the Supreme Court of the United States. And one of them was Justice Scalia. The other one is Clarence Thomas. Now, Clarence Thomas doesn't always agree with Justice Scalia, but he does a lot in different ways, and the reason is they're both originalists. They go back, and now Justice Scalia likes to talk a lot about, for example, capital punishment. Is capital punishment cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment? That came before the Supreme Court. People challenged it on that basis. They said this is cruel and unusual punishment, and the Eighth Amendment to our Constitution says that government can't have a cruel and unusual punishment. So he went back, and Clarence Thomas did too, and they looked and said, well, I can't find any of the states, the original 13 states, that believed that capital punishment was cruel and unusual. As a matter of fact, it's clear as crystal that it wasn't. And so they said, well, no, that's not cruel and unusual punishment on the basis of the original intent. And the rest of the court, the majority just disagreed. They said, well, we need to, that may be true, but that doesn't matter anymore. Because what we need to do is to interpret it and put our belief, our druthers, our wants on top of this, our wishes about the way things we think they ought to be. And so that's what they said. Now, he also makes the point, it's a good point, at the same time in the 13 original colonies, that hanging people was not cruel and unusual. If you were a felon, you got your ear cut off or it was notched, maiming you for life. And was that cruel and unusual punishment? No, they said that's not cruel and unusual. That was the original intent. Now, in those cases, fortunately for us, if some state wanted it, nobody does that in America anymore as an official act of punishment, I don't think. Branding people like they used to do in France, all cutting your nose off, all that. The states have the authority to make those calls, not the federal government. That's your point, and I understand what you're saying. Well, John, back to you. Originalism, that's what I wanted to talk about. I'm finished, and I appreciate the time. And the things that I have said, John, I'd like to repeat this, may or may not be the opinions of National Liberty Alliance, but I sure appreciate National Liberty Alliance allowing me to make a few points.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. All right. By the way, we have the queue open. There's nobody in it. Star 6 to get into the queue. Anybody has a question or a comment? Just go into the queue, star 6. I think it says star 6 and you have to hit 1. If I recall. Is that what it is, Jan, star 6 and 1? I've never been through the queue, so I don't know. Okay, we got a couple people coming in now.
Yeah, star what 6 is it? And then a 1.
Yeah, but there's no star in front of the 1, right?
No.
Good. Okay, we'll take our first caller. Let's see, Barrett, go right ahead. You got the mic.
Yeah, this is Barrett, North Carolina. I got a
Barrett?
Question for Brent.
Go ahead, we can hear you. Brent, maybe you can mute up.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Yes. U.S. Code, Title 8, Section 1450.
You're too far away from your mic. I hear you faintly in the background. Title 6 something or other.
Yes, Title 8.
Can you get closer to the mic or to your phone?
Let me see if I can turn it up. Go to another caller. I'll come back.
All right, you'll have to get star 6 to get back in then. Matter of fact, you should do that as soon as I take the next caller. Okay, let's go to Miller. You got the mic. And by the way, there's nobody else in the queue. Star 6 to get into the queue. Star 6 and a 1. Go ahead, Miller.
Hello, this is Benjamin. I spoke to you twice before about my mother, who was 91 years old now. It was an abusive guardianship case going on.
Mm-hmm.
And on October October 28th on a Sunday at 4 p.m., I get an email. They want me in court at 4 o'clock the next day. Emergency hearing. They want to throw me out of the house and have 24-hour care for my mother. So I disqualified the lawyer based on all the bad stuff. I said I'd disqualify her, you, and she quit 2 days later. Then they got a new judge on the case. An hour and a half after I went to the state capitol to file appeal papers, this new judge called a conference call with all the lawyers. And so they want to have a trial for a guardianship case. Well, they wanted me to go. My mother and I had to go to depositions last week, but we didn't go. And I've been filing papers. And now the judge has turned the corners and says that the plaintiff has to. I submitted an order today, and the judge actually filled it out. And that they want, and she says that they have to prove that the initial documents were properly given. They have to prove that the psychological evaluation that the court has been relying upon is sufficient, true, and correct without misrepresented or having misleading facts or contents in its material, because I wrote a rebuttal about the fraudulent psychologist. And they have to show up Friday, people who serve the papers, to prove that they have authority within these matters. So it's a whole long story, but
just from listening, just from listening to what you're telling me here, and I kind of vaguely remember some of the stuff. We've had a lot of people talk about different cases, but I kind of remember a lot of your stuff. And it sounds to me that they're kind of waffling, and you got to ask yourself, why are they doing that? What's going on here? I suspect strongly they can't prove fiduciary authority over your mother, okay? And that being the case, you're in a state court. You should move this into federal court very quickly. The due process has not been given. And that's why they're trying to get a hearing now. They're trying to seize control, authority over your mother. That's what it is. The judge probably gave some authority to some individual to take control, but never had the authority to give the authority. You know, when it comes to money and things of that nature, there's what's called a proof of claim. And then, of course, the second thing is the fiduciary authority to go forward with it. And in this kind of a case where they take control of an individual, you know, I wouldn't call it proof. Maybe it is a proof of claim. I don't know, Brent, if you're available, do they have something like that? When they try to seize control of a person, when a court tries to do that, first of all, they have to have proof of something, like a proof of a claim.
Usually when that happens, it's after a judgment. The court, my experience, I didn't learn this in law school. I learned it before. I saw somebody else do it. I tried it, and it worked. It's called a body attachment, where they issue a warrant throughout the state, usually. And the warrant is to attach the body and bring the person into court. It's not a criminal matter. It's just a civil matter. And what it boils down to is the judge wants to talk to him, and he won't come in, so he has the sheriff go out as a deputy and attach his body and bring it in. I don't know if that applies.
Well,
there,
well, if you have a warrant, it still has to fall under the Constitution, which means it needs to have some kind of a sworn statement and something behind it. You know, it's like you can't just seize property without having a sworn affidavit. Obviously, you can't seize an individual without having a sworn affidavit or put forth a warrant on a person. Are you familiar with how they went through that process? What did they do? Did they have someone to swear a statement or something?
No. They wanted a deposition. See, the judge said he wanted a trial, so they were going to put it on trial. But
but they're taking control of your mother, okay? And they're trying to take control of her assets because that's what it's all about. If I recall, you know, she has some assets. You know, they're not going to go chasing after someone who has nothing. They're not going to do anything for that purpose. So, Brent, can you mute your mic when you're not talking? You come
yes.
through. You know, there's a warrant. I mean, there's got to be something. I mean, they just can't act and do and say, okay, we're going to appoint you to do this, and we're going to do that. Wait, whoa, there's got to be something to cause that. It's no matter what you call it, it's called due process. And it has to be an affidavit somewhere, some kind of a sworn statement of this being the case, and this is why this must be done. And I know when it comes to money, for instance, under certain situations, you know, it's a proof of claim. Do you have a proof of claim? And I guess it would be called the same thing. What's the proof of claim? Where is a sworn affidavit concerning the situation and why something should be seized? And by what fiduciary authority do they act? Okay? Those are the two points.
Well, right. And they don't have either one because...
That's why you need to move into a federal court as soon as possible. You need to move into there for cause. They don't have any power authority over you. They're not giving you any due process, and you want them to cease and desist. Period. And that's the relief you're looking for from the court. You're not going to try the case there. You don't never try the case. You're trying a constitutional issue, and that's the only power and authority that the federal courts really have to hear on. I mean, there's others, but generally speaking, as far as the people are concerned, it's ultimately, you know, a constitutional issue. Now, you know, there are U.S. titles and different things going on in those courts. It's a whole different ballgame. But as far as the people are concerned, as far as the people getting justice, the Constitution is clear that they have the jurisdiction whenever any kind of a problem comes up concerning the Constitution. And therefore, if an unalienable right of yours is being abused and is protected by the Constitution, even if it isn't, you can then, because, you know, there's more rights than what we have there, but you can then move it into the federal court for the constitutional issue. And what is it, the issue? They don't have fiduciary authority. No one gave it to them. They don't have any kind of proof of claim. Nobody's sworn an affidavit. There is no warrant. They're kind of just coming out here on a fishing trip, trying to take control of my mother, so on and so forth. And you're moving towards, they can't prove that they have those things. So your wherefore clause is moving for them to cease and desist and leave you alone and don't bother you no more. Because that's your conclusion. And that's all you ask in federal court for, and that's all you need to ask. Now, if you can win that in federal court, you can then go sue for whatever damages. And any money they've taken out of your mother, they got a problem. And again, I'm suspecting they have a problem because from listening to your story, they're waffling. They're now going, let's get a court case going. Let's get something going. Let's get a hearing. Let's get some kind of ruling or something because we really shouldn't have been doing this. That's what I'm sensing. And if that's true, okay, now you win in the federal courts on that. Now you take it back into the state court and you sue for damages and the return of monies because you know I think if I recall, you transferred funds or something to another bank or something. I forget what it was. Was that you?
Well, the Guardian took the huge amount of hundreds of thousands of dollars out of one of her banks. And took it.
And what are they spending these hundreds of thousands of dollars on? What's the fruits of the money?
Well, he doesn't pay the rent. He pays for psychologists ad infinitum.
Whoa. You see, here's another problem here. They're making your mother pray for a psychologist so that they can take the rights of your mother away from her. That's the absurdest thing I've ever heard.
And the Guardian hired an accounting firm to do my mother's taxes, but I didn't hear the... he gave an accounting once of all... he took the money around March or April. He gave an accounting once, and he did. I don't know how much the accounting firm got paid for this. Also, he...
everything here, as I'm hearing and listening, everything here is being done, it appears to be, being done unlawfully. They've lacked the most important thing. It's called authority and jurisdiction over, okay? They're lacking those two things. They have to seize control, get the authority. They have to have the jurisdiction. And it sounds to me... again, they're waffling because they don't have that. Now they're trying to move towards getting it. But, you see, they've already committed the crime, okay? And they're on a fishing expedition. What's the purpose of the psychological on your mother? What's that purpose? What's the purpose?
Well,
she's 90-something years old, of course.
91.
You know, she's probably...
She's 91. She had two psychological evaluations. We hired two psychologists before the first hearing, and they both said she doesn't need a guardian. Then they tried to say that she was under undue influence and vulnerable to me, quoted some law, and they tried to pull that one. And then...
Okay, again, that proves a fishing expedition in order to take control of an estate. That right there, you just laid out a case. And you know, I think we spoke last time, and I told you need to do the federal court on this.
I understand. I just want to say one more thing. We were in court, and at 5 o'clock... the judge says, I don't want to, we're going off the record now. And when she was off the record, the guardian asked her for $39,000 for himself. And on the plaque, in the courtroom, on the desk, it says that the tape recordings go off, I think around 8 o'clock or 7:30, something like that, p.m. So, like, I thought that was totally weird. And I have to figure out whether there's any record of anything of what went on after 5 p.m. Because that was, like, totally weird, totally insane.
Uh-huh.
And so that was, I understand what you're saying.
Why did they want to go off the record? What did they talk about?
Oh, fees. I don't know. I don't remember what happened after 5 o'clock, but I know a huge part of the hearing they were arguing over fees, how to dish out the money. And every lawyer kept on asking for his money.
That's all it's about. You know, you get those. You got to get the transcripts on that because that shows the vultures. You know, they're out there just trying to pick off, whatever money they can get out of any source within the estate that your mother has. They're taking advantage of the elderly. They're taking advantage. This is RICO. This is what it is. It's RICO. I'm so sick of it. I see it throughout the courts just about everywhere. Nothing but money. That's what it's about, money.
Yes, it's obvious. So that's
so obvious that you got a great case and you need to be moving that case. First of all, you have to deal with your constitutional issues that are being violated and get a ruling from the federal court. And you have to be clear and pushy in the federal court to some degree. You got to lock them down to where they can't move anywhere. Remember, there's a couple of things about this case, okay? Number one, it's really not a big, hot political issue, okay? So the judge is not going to be, you know, easily swayed to maintain status quo as they normally would with other cases. It is an issue that there's a lot of money being made in these courts that seize control of the people and their assets and so on and so forth. But I just don't think if you can get a good case, if you give this judge no place to hang his hat, keep it simple, you know, that's the best way to go, keeping it simple. I have a case that has been coming and going for years, and one of the things I realized is only if I understood better to have kept it simple because they've taken the opportunity to use a lot of information over the course of a long period of time and then, you know, twist the words to create, a position or an idea in the court of what they want to, get out there. And really what they're talking about or seeing is really gets down to the basics of my learning curve, you know what I mean? And believe me, I've learned from this. Don't bring nothing up in court that doesn't need to be there. Get rid of all the smoke and mirrors and just get rid of everything and keep right to the facts, okay? And the fact is very simple. You discover what violations are upon you as far as constitutional issues are concerned for the court and focus in due process, obviously. Where is the fiduciary authority? I've seen no credible witness or statement or documentation. That's a word. I see no credible documentation. Where's the fiduciary authority? Where is the original claim? Why, as the two psychiatrists came up with conclusions that we paid for, now they forced my mother to pay for another psychiatrist so that they can get their own psychiatrist who will give a different opinion. You know, I don't know that I'd bring that part up into the court. See, that part, you're going to want that for your case, for your lawsuit. You're going to want to sue all these lawyers and get your money back plus some, okay? There's a principle in the Bible. You know, you steal a man's ox, you got to give him back three. And I think it's three, or maybe it's four. You know, you can look up that principle. There's different issues under different things, and I'm not sure exactly why God puts it this way or that way. Different animals are worth more value to something. I don't know. But in any event, the principle is there. So, you know, if you stole $100,000, I want $300,000 or $400,000 back, because that's what's right. The pain, the suffering, the costs, the disconnect. I mean, this is affecting your mother too. I mean, you're not having that relationship at the end of her years, the twilight years, and here it is. These people are, and that's got to be a stress. I'm sure she realizes what's going on, right? Well, she's got her mind about her enough to know.
Beyond that, she's almost totally lucid. To get this, the Guardian took the mail. She missed her son's wedding invitation, and she didn't get any mail from her extended family, which means a lot to her. It keeps her spirits up and so forth. So we're fooling that, too. I mean, it's
right.
Unbelievable.
Well, I'd have two court cases going if I were you. First of all, the federal court and get the decision, cease and desist. Second court case, as soon as that's done, is move that with that decision, bring in all of these the paperwork necessary, and lay out a court. You want to get a court of record. That's the tough one to get. And, you know, when you're going into a federal court for a decision, you know, you can look for a court of record there, but, you write it up as a court of record. They're not going to give you a court of record. It's going to be an equity court. The judge is going to make a decision. If he makes the wrong decision, you can object. You can't come up with a summary judgment here. This is a court of record. You're giving me a summary judgment. No, I want the people here. You see, that's if they go the wrong way. You also have in a federal court, if you got a good solid case and the judge makes a wrong decision, there's a rule called Rule 35, which you know, you then can push for a panel to hear to take a look at the case, okay, and get a you know, so it's an appellate process within the system without having going up to the appellate, because it's really what's called a reconsideration. And in the reconsideration under Rule 35 in the federal court, what it says is that you can either ask the judge to reconsider, or you can ask a panel to and I perceive that would be a panel of a few judges, probably in the district. I don't know where they would get them from. I would hope the district next door or something, you know, not the same judges in the same house, so to speak. But in any event, you get a panel. And that's the secondary thing. The third thing from there, of course, you can go through the appeal. And you might get a good shot at the appeal. I think the appellate court in the federal level is reasonably decent. There's some bad apples there, of course. New York was a major problem. Trump sent a whole bunch of new judges down there. I don't know, not a lot. I don't remember how many, three or four or something, maybe a little more. So he got rid of some bad apples down there. But generally speaking, I think the appellate courts probably make some decent decisions. So if you've got a good solid case and you keep it really, really focused and don't get lost in details that don't need to be in that case, it's all about the issue of an unalienable right being violated, okay? Let me go back to what it is. You're not getting the proper due process. They've acted without fiduciary authority. They've stole without fiduciary authority and without a claim. no proof of claim, no sworn affidavits, nothing. Judge had no power, no authority to do anything. And who questioned, what caused the action to question your mother that she, that you went out to get a psychological on her? What was the original cause that brought this thing into play?
She was having very slight memory issues, and we all know that memory doesn't have to do with judgment. But it was just slight memory issues.
Right, I got memory issues. Maybe they're going to come take everything I own, too.
Well, if they could, they would. So they.
I know.
So they, my brothers decided that he's going to file papers to be her guardian and power of attorney, and he started it. It was my cousin, the lawyer.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, you gotta move forward. You gotta shut them down to begin with, and then sue the hell out of them. Personally,
oh, yeah.
Go in there. Look at once they step outside, once they break the law, they have no immunity. Okay, they seem to think they can do whatever they please and even break the law. I'm immune, you know. But, although we're not immune, we don't have immunity. They won't give it to us, right? But they'll take it for sure. We're not sovereign, but they're sovereign.
Have you ever heard of a court-appointed lawyer? Having the client having to pay a court-appointed lawyer, because my mother had to pay court-appointed lawyers to the tune of about $60,000.
Yeah, you want all that money back. This whole thing is a fraud, and anything it touches from the point of the fraud, as soon as the fraud begins, it begins at the beginning. Everything from there on, they're responsible. All the damages, they're responsible. All the money they stole, they're responsible. So you need to get a lot. You need to go and get all of the records you can from this court. Every paper, every document filed in this record you want to get. You want to get the minutes. You want to get the recordings, not just the typed out minutes. You want a copy of the recordings. And I would ask for these things the next time you go into the court, on and for the record, this is what I want. I want the recording that's playing right now and every single hearing that's connected to this case from day one. We want a copy of all documentations, all records. I'll go see the clerk at the end of this day, at the end of this hearing, and I'm going to expect to get that. And I'm going to expect to be able to get the recordings. I'll sit and wait for that. And then I want the transcripts also, okay? I want all the transcripts. You see, because the transcripts have already been typed out. And if they, you know, glazed over a few areas from the recording to the transcript, you're going to be able to pick that up. And, again, it's another bullet, so to speak, or a nail in their coffin.
Sounds good to me. Okay.
You know, and you can come back. You know, this is recorded. It's uploaded at the end of the evening, and you can come back tomorrow or tonight or whatever and download this MP3 and come to this area to re-listen to some of the things that I spoke about.
Well, that's cool. Cool. Thank you. It's quite just amazing. It's just amazing. That's all I can say.
Keep an eye on what we're doing because we're getting ready to file a paper shortly. We have a new strategy on how we might go about opening up, putting them in a position to shine the light on the fact that they have concealed the only court of justice in the land. They've concealed it in every federal courthouse and every state courthouse. They have concealed it. And, you know, we have a kind of a strategy, and we'll see where that goes, and you can mimic that strategy once you see it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And hopefully it'll work. I mean, look at, you know, what's gonna take a win in this is to put the pressure on so heavy on these judges and all these people involved to the point that they come to realize they're going to be held liable for subversion, okay? You know, they're subverting the process, subverting the people, they're subverting the Constitution. They're preventing access to courts of justice. They've hidden it. That's 20 years in jail for a judge, by the way. That's what their statutes call for concealment. When a judge gets involved and presses the pressure onto a clerk or anyone else to conceal, it's, I don't know whether it's 1 or 3 years for the clerk, but for the person pressing the issue, which would be the judge, it's 20 years. And, you know, that should put a little fear in them. But look, at these people are going to have to step up and start getting behind the people. And at some point, that's got to have to happen. You know, we'll give them the olive branch as much as we can. But there comes a point in time we're just going to write indictments. And it'll be eventually dealt with because everything is reset, being reset, with the draining of the swamp. Hopefully the big things are going to happen soon, I hope. But, you know, we have to have patience with that. You know, I understand the plan. You know, we've had a plan for, goodness, it's been 6 years. Our original plan, you know, in the beginning, it took a little while to develop it, but we've been on a plan for about 4 years, let's say, and the 6 years we've been doing this. We've had a focus and a plan, a place to get to. And we're about moving to that place we've been looking for 4 years. And a lot of people have brought up different things from time to time, not a lot, but a few people, from time to time, you know, how come this, how come that, you know, well, we're not ready for this, we can't, you know. Well, first, there was a lot of construction we had to do here at NLA in order to get to a position where we thought we would have some clout and some power, some authority. And they wouldn't be able to say, oh, you're just a few people out there in New York and so on. And, you know, no, we're in every state of the union. We're in probably better than three quarters, I'm guessing. But I think we're better than three quarters of the counties of the nation. We got people in three quarters of the counties. you know, when our founders got together and signed the paper to make big changes, it was 56 of them, I believe. Okay. Well, we got over 7,000. Right, plus and counting. We need that critical mass, but we got thousands, and we can show proof. You know, just by laying out our case, we can show clearly the violation of just about every article in the Constitution, of every article of the Bill of Rights. You know, we can show that they violated it all constantly and consistently, and made money by doing it. The whole thing, you know. And this is a conspiracy. It starts at an educational level. The Bar Association started this conspiracy. They took over the courts. That was their plan. They've shut out the people. They've closed the doors to courts of justice. And all of this over a period of time. You know, and it all started, it started in the beginning, actually. It started in the arguments of the Federalists. I mean, Jefferson spoke about the enemies already in the game. He wanted to root them out. Jackson used the same kind of language. He wanted to root them out. He was talking about the bankers, and so was Jefferson, because that was who the enemy was, getting that bank together to get to control the money of the nation. They had already controlled England. Now they wanted to control, or shall I say Britain, they want to control America's. Now that the break was taking place. Anyway. Anything else? We'll move to the next caller.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Okay, Barrett, I see you're back. Go right ahead.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Great. This is Barrett from North Carolina. I was wanting to talk about political status, you know, citizenship and jurisdiction.
Political what?
Political status.
Okay.
Or citizenship. I was noticing, I'll pull it up here, hang on just 1 second. Title 18, Section 9/11. Whoever falsely and willfully represents himself to be a citizen of the United States, it just went away on me, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 3 years.
For anybody who what now with a citizen?
Whoever willfully presents himself to be a citizen of the United States.
And this is in Title 18, 9/11?
Section 9/11. Whoever falsely okay. willfully represents himself as a citizen of the United States shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for 3 years.
Yeah, but this must be in the context of something else. There must be a something.
That's what I'm getting at.
Okay.
Hold on, I'll bring another one up. U.S. Code Title 8, Section 1452. That's immigration and nationality. The application to the Secretary of State for Certificate of Non-Citizen National Status, proof, an oath of allegiance. A person who claims to be a national but not a citizen of the United States may apply to the Secretary of State for Certificate of Non-Citizen National Status upon upon proof of satisfaction from the Secretary of State that the applicant is a national but not a citizen of the United States. That would be a state citizen.
Well, you see, there's a game being played there, and I don't know what it is. I have not really studied USC 18. I haven't studied any of the titles, to be honest with you. I did study them to see, you know, what authority, what jurisdictions, also looking into if they had authority to write these titles, and. You know, I think I need deeper research, but at this point, I think all of the titles that I have seen, with the exception of USC 26, I think are lawful. Now, inside those things may be unlawful things, okay? That's a study in itself. Some of these titles are thousands of pages long, and, you know, US 26, just take that, that's 14,000. No, I think it's like 19,000 pages now. I mean, 9,000 pages. You know, but there are titles that have thousands of pages. You know, take USC 18 has a little over 1,400 pages. Okay, so there's a lot of stuff in there. Now, my concern and your concern and the concern of most of the people involved here is really dealing with courts of justice opening them up. Courts of justice will shut down any of this equity stuff that they've got written. These are all what's called positive law. USC 18 is supposed to have been, become law. It's been what's called enacted into positive law. The other one you mentioned was 8, right? USC 18. Yeah, I don't know whether 8 is common, is enacted into law. But what that means, there are 26 or 27. I'll say 26. Let me think about this. Yeah, 26. USC 28 is actually the rules of civil procedure, which applies to all of these different titles, okay? They may open criminal, they may open civil, but nevertheless, it's a civil procedure. In Title USC 18, where the penal code is at, they have the rules of criminal procedure, okay? And so, but USC 28 is what they use. That's where the rules are found, the rules of the court, okay? Rule 35, which I mentioned earlier. Which, by the way, we've got to be careful when we use those rules in the court. We have to make it clear that these are their rules that deal with equity and not us. It's nothing to do with us, but we've got to be very savvy on how we put that, state that, because they will take a statement like that, distort it to make you look insane, okay? So you've got to be very, very subtle on how you do it. I like to do it through footnotes, okay, sort of sewing footnotes together and making clear the meaning of what I'm saying and using, let the United States Supreme Court, ultimately, under American jurisprudence, you know, the big decisions, let them make the case for you. And that's what I do. I let them make the case. They say, oh, you said this and you said that. No, I never said that. That court said that, or Jefferson said that. Yeah, I didn't say that. I was just quoting them. You know, and that kind of throws them off their, you know, balance a little bit. But the thing is you got to get in there and you got to make positions and you got to be careful on how you use their equity statutes or codes, procedures. You know, going back to the 26 positive law titles. There are 26 of them, and then 27 would be the USC 28, which relates to all of them. Okay, they are cases that can be heard directly into the federal court. If an issue comes up, they go right into the federal court, and the case is heard under those titles. Okay, under the other titles, they're more like regulations, rules, procedures. They have not been enacted into law, but what they have is they have administrative courts. Okay. If you go to the Department of Labor, there's an administrative court. Okay, once you start to participate with that, now you're stuck in the system, and you have to take it all the way through. If you lose, you got to pay up before you can move into the state court. In the case of state courts, anyway. But you can move your case if you don't get the decision you want in the administrative court. You can then move it into the federal court, and They are required to hear those issues, okay? But of course, you have to have a good reason to get in there, and of course that's laid out in the beginning of your case, and the other side will make the argument if you don't have a good case to get in, and you know try to have your case thrown out or whatever. But you can move it into federal court. So you need to, people need to understand how this law is put together. We don't need to understand all about Title 18 and 28 and 8 and 26. We don't need to know all that stuff because it doesn't affect us. But if you are in business doing something, huh?
It actually does.
Well, it doesn't affect us. I'll tell you why, because it all identifies with what goes on in territories, okay? And the bottom line, it's all fraud, isn't it? It all is in violation. What they're interpreting to try to make a citizen something that it isn't, okay, and they've been doing this, they're trying to change the meanings of words, for instance, in Black's Law Dictionary. You know, you take that. I've come to agree with Bill Thornton on this idea that one of the best dictionaries to use is Black's Fourth, okay? Bobier is okay, too, but it really lacks a lot. Blacks is much more, got a lot more information, a lot more things happening, you know, as far as information is concerned. But what they try to do is they, over time, they try to change the meaning of a word to something else. And if they can get a court decision, to make that change, that'll be really helpful for them. But it takes a long time to change the meaning of a word. They've been working on citizen for a couple hundred years now, I'm sure, at least going back into the 20th century, coming into the 20th century. They've been working on the citizen thing. It's all about slavery, making a subject, citizens, subjects. Okay? Our founding fathers used the word citizen, and I believe it's even used in the Constitution. Okay? And I'll double-check that shortly, maybe when I get a chance,
well,
as we're talking.
Well, the Constitution, you were a citizen of your state.
Yeah, but we created a more perfect union. Okay, the United States, we the people under the Constitution gave the authority in order to create, you know, to have people, you create the system, the necessary legal process to make citizens of people who are not citizens of this nation, of this nation, I'll say, and when they come in, they become what they call is a U.S. citizen, which we're all U.S. citizens ultimately in a logical sense, okay? Well, not the way they do. Look at what they're doing is fraud. It's all constructive fraud. They are creating, and let me tell you, I learned this from studying things that I had to study in USC 26, okay? Where it's a construction of things. You know, they'll refer to a statute, and you'll go read it, and you say, oh, wow, you know, this is not good for me, you know? But there's other references in that statute, as per this, and the meaning of the word that. What's the phrase this? What does this phrase mean? What does this word mean? So when you start to trace that down, you say, oh, this has nothing to do with me. But on the surface, you don't see that. And that's what we're up against. It's called fraud. And they're doing it in order to subvert our Constitution. And that's treason.
Yeah, but what it is what I'm trying to say is you can remove yourself from that federal jurisdiction. Once you've done that,
you can't do that. You think you could do that, but you really can't. No matter what you do, if they decide to leave you alone, let this guy go. And 6 months, 6 years from now, it's time to go out for this guy. They don't care what you've done. They're going to take you into the courts. They're going to do whatever they please with you. They're going to have their way with you. You know, the other thing is you're also reporting yourself to them as an individual that disagrees, and, you know, you're one of the first ones they're going to go out after when the time comes. Of course, that time isn't going to come anymore, I don't think. I think Trump is going to prevent that from happening. But nevertheless, this is the whole thing. You want to be careful. Also, I will tell you, and I know this from experience. I mentioned this earlier. There are things I've said in courts, earlier court cases or in papers that I wish I didn't say, because they take that to make you look like a nut to begin with, okay? And that you're antisocial, that you're anti-law, and all these other things, and you find yourself battling 20 different things, and you can never get to the real point that you're in court for. And this is part of their strategy. So don't play their game. Call it for what it is, and they won't expound on it because you're calling it for what it is. It's a fraud. It's a crime. It's constructive criminality of the system. They had
to give you an out. They couldn't do the fraud without giving you.
Nah, you know, maybe, but they don't care about that. You're just a mock now somewhere. They may leave you alone for a while until the time comes. You'll be the first one they're coming out after. That's the problem on the other side of that coin. Okay, now why play the game with the out on fraud? I don't want the fraud at all. Let's open courts of justice and let's work there, okay? You know, you come out after the people, you need to come decided by the people. You have to come to the people to get your indictment. You got to come to the people to be judged, and they're going to hear the case without any instructions from the judge, without any influence from the judge at all in any way, shape, or form, and in the way of the grand jury, without the influence of the prosecutor. Lay your case down, get out of the room, we'll chew it up and figure out what we're going to do with it, you know? But, of course, every jury is stacked. Every grand jury is stacked. Every trial jury is stacked. There's no way they're going to allow the people to come really make decisions. They're going to make it look that way for as long as they can, till they can get rid of it. There are states moving towards getting rid of the grand jury system. Can you imagine that? I mean, this is what America was built upon. That is our heritage, okay? Natural law is our heritage. People need to understand that. And they whittled it away. They've concealed it. They've hidden it. And they've changed things. Look, you got the common law, and they flip it around and say, yeah, that's the decisions of all these courts, whether it's federal or state, collectively, and we can draw upon them, and this decision decided this on that. Well, wait a second. If you're going to decide, things aren't exactly the same to begin with. And a lot of these judges, they make up law. I mean, in New York State, they quote it is appellate court. It's an appellate court decision that they quote where they say that common law has been abrogated, okay? And, I mean, come on. You don't even have to think about that anymore. That you can immediately move into the federal court, and you should be able to win that, maybe, okay, maybe.
Well,
it depends on how. Huh?
Our statutes, common law, is declared still in force in North Carolina.
I'll say that again.
North Carolina is declared still in force.
Declared what still in force?
Common law.
And matter of fact, the grand jury in the New York State Constitution has been declared to never be abrogated. Okay, that was back in the big battle when this case came up and other things were taking place between 1939 and 1949. Big things were happening, and they called for a convention, and it turned up that there was more push towards maintaining and keeping the grand juries than getting rid of them, because they want to get rid of grand juries. They want to get a panel of educated bar judges. You know, they want to, after all, they know the law, you know. But certainly they don't know the law of God. They're at enemy with God. God, you know, you go back into the Bible, you know, God, Christ cursed them. You know, they prevent everyone from coming in. They put burdens upon men. And so, you know, there's no blessing there. And they want to cover that law up. That's what they want to do, because that's the natural law. That's the real common law. But anyway, look at. It's all about subversion. It starts with education. Starts with changing the meanings of words. Look at when I first got into this, I started to look at some of these things because I had an IRS problem going back in the late 90s, and I started reading some of this stuff and looking into a lot of things, and saw that they had a place where they gave the meaning of words. Okay. And so you go and look, and they'll say the state means this, and the United States means that. Well, the United States doesn't mean what you and I think, the common person, when they use the word United States in USC 26. What it means to them is Guam, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and other federal territories. That's what that means. So when they talk about the United States, or they talk about states, they're talking about a whole different jurisdiction, a whole different territorial, geographical, territorial, you know, jurisdiction, okay, than what you and I, the common person, would read and understand. But if you don't know those little secrets, then you can't really battle them, people. But the other thing in, well, there's a lot of things in USC 26, that, because I'm somewhat familiar with that because I had to deal with that years ago. And USC 18, penal code, null and void, means nothing, can't be applied. USC 18, if you go into Title 18, you discover the jurisdiction is maritime law, has nothing to do with the law of the land. Okay? But people go to jail all day long under penal codes under USC 18.
All crimes are commercial.
Well, again, it has nothing to do with we the people. That's why we got to get our courts of law back open. It's the only way we're going to win this thing. People need to understand what the meanings of these things are. They need to understand these issues, because if they don't, they can't battle them. You can't defeat an enemy you do not understand. You can't just go to war and just go to war against somebody and know nothing about them. You need to send your spies in. You need to study these people. You have to look at their history, see what's going on, see what their strategies, their philosophies are. You need to understand your enemy, okay, or you'll never win. So we need to understand what the enemy is doing so we can show that it's unlawful. And that's, you know, but again, this doesn't apply to you and me. I can tell you right now, USC 18, jurisdiction, you should be able to beat the court by they lack jurisdiction. You can challenge the jurisdiction. You can require the court to put onto the paper, what jurisdiction am I in, Judge? I don't know the jurisdiction, so it's difficult for me to, USC 18, there's a, okay, well, what's the jurisdiction for USC 18? Can you please apply that on the record? Maritime law, you think they're going to put that on the record? But again, now, you got to give them an out, too. You got to realize that you're not here to win the war here. You can only win a battle for yourself. The war, it has to be fought collectively, and that's what we're doing here. We're fighting it collectively. We're going in with a spearhead to break in and reveal the truth.
Agreed. We just had a big tax case, one here in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
They seized his property. They were going to sell it, and he challenged the jurisdiction of the court, and he proved they didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. It was a District Court of the United States, Western District of North Carolina. Well, the U.S. District Court was created as a territorial court for Hawaii. They dismissed his case without prejudice last week.
Well, look at the first thing you want to look at when you are pulled. If you're pulled into a court for some reason, the very first thing you want to look at is what is the subject matter jurisdiction? Do they have it? And you want to challenge also the personam jurisdiction. Do they have it? If their law is on the sea and I'm on the land, you don't have personam jurisdiction over me. But again, you want to do this in a subtle way when you make these positions, so you're giving them an out. And when the judge sees that, at least there's an opportunity to get that out. You know, you don't want to go hardcore on paper, clear as a bell, of what they're doing. Although, you know, the spearhead case will do that. That's the purpose of the spearhead case. But as far as a case that you're dealing with personally, you're trying to get out of their grips, And you get out of their grips, you're not going to go back and stick a stick back into the hornet's nest. You're going to let it go, you know, because it doesn't make sense to fight these people, because you can't win. That's the problem. Get a court of justice, now you can win. You can take them into the court of justice and deal with them there. You can indict a judge. You can indict a lawyer. You can indict the officers of the court. You can indict anyone. You know, if you can convince the jury, the grand jury, to give you an indictment, it's potentially possible.
Need to read Hale versus Henkel. It's an old Supreme Court case.
I'm familiar with Hale versus Henkel. Maybe not as much as I should. What's your point on Hale versus Henkel? It's got some powerful decisions in there.
Basically on the citizenship status. I read one Supreme Court case. I can't remember exactly the case anymore. I lost my computer and all my paperwork, but the state citizen is immune from government attack. Period.
Well, look, when you become a citizen, you're a citizen of any state of the union. Wherever you plant your seat, this is where I'm going to be. You're automatically a citizen. If I go to Jersey for the day, I'm a citizen of Jersey for the day. When I come back, I'm.
That's no.
Yes. That's not true. No, that's what they're talking about, to create a more perfect union. Okay, that's what that's all about. And the rights of the each state that you have the right to rest upon the rights of any state that you're in. You have a right to rest upon even the state of your state in the state that you're in. You have a right to rest upon, of course, the supremacy law, which of course is the Constitution. Okay, so all of that is there. They may twist these things around, but no, if I move to Jersey tomorrow. Okay, if I literally move to Jersey, I don't have to file no papers anywhere. I'm automatically a citizen of New Jersey, period. I'm protected by...
That's under the 14th Amendment, okay?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's Article 4, full faith and credit to begin with. And the citizens, Section 2, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of the citizens in the several states. And also, remember the preamble. Let me just finish this point, then I'll listen. Then also in the preamble, remember, the begins off, we the people, the United States. That's little, you know, united. I think that word should have been little u, and it may be in the original. I don't know, but in my booklet right here, it's capitalized. But we the people of the United States, okay, maybe in this case it should be capitalized because it's the creation of a federal government. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, goes on to establish justice, so on and so forth. That's the whole purpose, to form a more perfect union. We're not just a colony. We're not just a separate state. No, we're doing something very unique around a constitution that we the people established, ordained and established for them, and created this system. And we are, you can, you know, when they may call you a U.S. citizen, and I don't think that, I don't know whether that's proper or not, I have to look into that, and maybe they play in a game with those words, I'm sure they probably are, but you've been led astray on that one point. No, this whole thing was intended to be able to, that's why when they create, when you come in, if you're an alien coming into this nation, and you become a citizen of this nation, it's the federal government's job has been given to set forth the testing and the requirements in order for a person to become a citizen. Okay, they have that authority. We gave that to them in the Constitution. And so now they create the system, and wherever they plant themselves, they're a citizen of that state and of every other state, ultimately.
You're a citizen of the state you were born in.
Well, what about the people coming into this nation that are created citizens? It's in Article 1, Section 8, where that power and authority was given. What about those people?
That's to give them citizenship to the United States. It doesn't give them
citizenship. So they're not citizens. If they're living in New York, they're not citizens of New York?
Well, if you read the 14th Amendment, there are citizens...
I don't care about the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, as far as I'm concerned, is null and void. Okay, we know exactly what they did with the 14th Amendment. They tried to change meaning of words and meanings of things in it, and it talks about being subject to things. We're not subject to no one but God. Okay, so all of that is just, it's null and void anyway. It doesn't matter. I don't care what the 14th Amendment says. They've tried to change what is into something else and what it isn't, and they want to control the reality. If you tell a lie long enough, you'll believe it, okay? I'm looking for, let's see, migration, Article 8 talks about citizenship.
You got 1101 or 1408?
I'm sorry, 1101 what? 1408 what? Are you talking about titles?
No, there are sections of Title 8.
I don't care about Title 8. It doesn't apply to me. None of those titles apply to me unless you're participating in something out there. It doesn't apply to the people on the land. We're on the land. We have that. We're under the law. We're not under the equity. We're not under. We are not under. Never meant to be, and unfortunately, we are put under there. But we're not supposed to be under positive law. Okay, we're supposed to be under natural law, and there's a difference. Now, positive law is human-made law. We've never given authority to Congress to create any law that controls our behavior. So they don't have that power authority to do that. Okay?
I'm in agreement there. I mean, I read my state constitution. It defines the general laws as applying to all governmental units in the courts and to government employees, but it doesn't apply to the people.
Right, it has nothing to do with us. So I don't care what it says out there. I'll ignore it. Look, they're not going to bring it up in a court anyway, and if they do, then you can start to work towards the construction of fraud on that. It's very easy to prove fraud on all that. You can tie it all together. What are you talking about? This? Your conclusion is coming up, I'm a subject? Since when am I a subject? You're the subject. We the people ordained and established this for you. You have no power authority. We never gave you a power authority. Search the Constitution. See what authority we've given you to control our behavior, to write penal laws. You show me where. They can't do it, of course. So. I still can't. I don't know why I can't find this. I keep looking through this and I'm missing it. It must be combined with something else in here in the Article 8. The government of the United States legislature. Right, maybe someone knows which clause it is, but one of the clauses talks about writing the law for a person to become a citizen. Oh, here it is, to establish uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws subject to bankruptcies throughout the United States. So there's two different things going on in this particular clause. And this is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, 2, 3, Clause 4. We've given them the power and the authority to write law and to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. That is to create a citizen of an individual from a foreign nation, from a foreign state. They can come into the United States. There's rules and a process to become a citizen. And once you fulfill those rules and process and a test that they give you, you now raise your hand and you swear allegiance to the United States. And the United States could be considered more of a small U instead of a big U for the United States. But nevertheless, you're swearing the allegiance. Okay, now go live in the state you want to live in. Go plant yourself in New York. I'm a New Yorker. I got all the rights and all the privileges of any other New Yorker here. The Constitution of New York is here to protect me, except for where it's null and void because it is in conflict with the U.S. Constitution. Thankfully, they wrote it up that way, and you live your life there. Now, 10 years from now, I moved to Jersey. I had no paperwork, nothing. I'm a New Jerseyan. I got all the rights and privileges of New Jersey. Okay, and when I'm visiting Jersey, I got all the rights of New York and Jersey. I got the rights of all the states. I can use the power and the decisions of Supreme Courts in those cases that establish maybe. Jurisprudence for the state, for the judges of equity courts, but they established the jurisprudence. I've got all the rights. You see, but now they've distorted and played a game, and I know what you're saying because I came in that way. I came into my understanding that way, for the good or for bad. I think it injured me on the one hand, but without it, I would lack a certain understanding and knowledge of it. So I came in a good way, but I found the truth, and there's distortion there. Sometimes people just aren't doing their homework enough. That's a big problem. So, all right. Anyway, I should move on to the next caller. If you want to continue, you can get back into the queue. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
And of course, any other evening you want to come, but look at one of the problems I found, okay, because I was getting educated from websites and I relied too much on their research and therefore their conclusions. But then I started to see some contradictions. I started to see contradictions between sites, contradictions between working things out and conclusions, or a conclusion that just doesn't work with this conclusion. It's just a contradiction, you know? That's how you could tell truth. That's how a detective tells truth that tries to figure out who's guilty. They look for the contradictions. That's what we need to do, look for the contradictions. And after discovering the contradictions and so many of them, and it led to another one, I came to the realization everything I've been taught by all of these websites on all these things, I have to retest. And, of course, a lot of stuff is true, you know. But then they misinterpret and misunderstand it and apply wrong reasoning or logic to it. And then they throw away the baby with the bathwater, like with this issue here that we're talking about. They're just throwing it all away. But, no, the Constitution is clear. We gave that power and authority, and it means something. And we have all the rights of all the states and the rights, of course, of the U.S. Constitution and, you know, and so on. All right, but anyway, let me move on, and we'll talk again maybe if you want. Anybody else wants to? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said all right.
All right, thanks. It was a good call. Thank you. Anybody else wants to get into the queue? We only got a couple of people in the queue, star 6 and star 1 to get into the queue. Crystal Mac, how you doing?
Hello.
Hey, how you doing? How you feeling?
I'm kind of like, I have this awful flu.
Heavy vitamin C. Heavy yeah. Vitamin C.
I've been doing the crystal vitamin C, and I've been doing the olive oil.
Yeah, I'd go about 20 grams. Do about 20 grams, and if you need, go more until
mm-hmm.
you flush out. Pump yourself
right.
up and maintain that high level, reducing it as days go by, and it'll shorten and your illness and
I'm feeling much better now than I was. I just received a letter back, unsigned. Again, that 1938 form, the foreign agent, where they have no jurisdiction, and we saw that they're not even registered with the W-9 in Washington. So they've been using our Social Security number, and when they do the foreclosure is, when we abandon our home. So when they go to file the paperwork in the clerk's office, they write abandonment, and then they get their little affidavits notarized, and they bring it to the judge, and the judge says, okay, we can foreclose on it because we abandoned our property.
So you're aware of the fact that they filed a paper claiming it was abandoned?
Well, that's how they've been filing the papers on the foreclosures.
Okay.
And
well,
so you've exposed that
in the court.
I didn't put that in there yet because I was checking out a few other people who I knew how they lost their homes, and on the paperwork they write abandonment. I said, "Well, wait a minute." And so one of the people I know, I said, "On your paperwork, what do they give you?" She goes, "They sent me the paperwork abandonment." I said, "Hold on to that. You didn't abandon your house because we were there when they put you out."
Mm-hmm.
You know. So
right.
I said, this is criminal, what they've been doing. So
that's
we checked
right.
out a few other towns. And I said, oh, my God, this is what foreclosure. So we found out, what is foreclosure? Foreclosure is when you abandon your property. No, the people are not abandoning it. They are being forced out their property. And
without
state,
due process, might I
without,
add.
Exactly. And I said, and also, I said, what was it? When they, I said, when we called the police and all that other stuff, they took up for their side. But this is something else I did, too, several months ago. I went and I filed a police report, and I'm so glad I did that, about the illegal foreclosure. Well, of course, they didn't want to give me a police report. And I said, I didn't ask you to... I did not ask you to sit there and resolve the case. I'm filing a police report on this is criminal activity that's happening because I have the proof that this is my property. I have the notarized sworn affidavits, volume and page, and everything. and here is. I said, you don't have to. And I said, I'd rather for you not to give your opinion. He goes, well, I said, because you don't even understand the Constitution and the law pertaining why I'm writing this, you know. And so, of course, he sat there. He wrote the report. I went and picked my copies up. And he put his opinion in it, which he didn't know no more than the rabbit in the hat knew. Okay? Mm. But that's besides the point. So I said, let me put that aside. So when I put everything together, I got my police report. I also have my subrogation, the proof of claim, no due process. Then I also put that, you got the paperwork, the foreign agent of 1938, which they have no jurisdiction over us. In any case, an attorney or a judge, when they file, they have to be on file down there. So it's on that website. They're not even registered down there. So they have literally no jurisdiction. They are foreign agents.
Did you challenge that jurisdiction?
I put that in there also. So also,
yeah, but you got to make it. You got to move the court to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction.
That's what I did, and I put that in there. So when I went to the court, because remember I told you that was on November 5th, and I had it stamped, and I had it put. I said I want this in my file, and so that's when, and that Friday before, because when I had got out the hospital, I faxed it over to the attorneys and the court. They did not show up in court. So I had to have it marked ready. And so when I got to court, I was the first case that was called. And I saw the clerk. He ran upstairs and told the judge. And so, and the other attorneys, they never showed up. So when she called my name, I said my name. I'm the authorized representative, and I gave my name. I'm her agent, and I said motion ready. And when she called the other party, they were not there. I said I would like this. I said they are in default. I would like this case to be totally discharged and dismissed because they're not here. She goes, well, we'll give them time to get here. So she went around giving, you know, calling the names on the case that were coming up. And then she comes back to me and she goes, well, they're not here. So meanwhile, the other attorney, she came a little later. So she was all smile. And then when she heard that they wasn't here, she went out and she came back and she looked very sick when she came back. Like the smile was on her face. And again, I asked the judge, I would like this. I said, you're on default. I would like this case to be totally discharged and dismissed. She goes, I'm not going to let you speak. I'm going to.
And this is a new judge now, right?
This is a new judge, right?
Didn't we talk about doing an amicus curiae?
Yeah, but we never. Yeah,
but we need to get together to do that. It should be simple from our perspective because we pretty much have it written out on non-traditional foreclosures, and we just got to add in some things and just get some information on your case.
Okay.
You know, I'll try to work on it this week if I can to get it completed, and then we can utilize this for anybody that has a non-judicial foreclosure problem.
Okay.
And we will write it with the threat of indictment to be brought before the full grand jury from the perspective of the grand jury being the sureties of the peace, sending out four to solve the problem. That's who we are. And if you don't want to straighten your problem out and obey the law, and stop acting in these unlawful ways, then we will take you before the full grand jury for potential indictment. And of course, we'll get it, I'm sure. But,
okay.
You know,
okay.
And maybe that will, because she has it, she just got involved. We'll write it and we'll put your court case number and everything up on it.
Okay, thank you. Also, before I forget, next.
What I'd like you to do, though, before you go on to that, what I'd like you to do, you've sent me a lot of papers, and I've got a lot of stuff here, and a lot of it I haven't been able to go through. I breezed through the stuff, but I do have it here. But what you could do maybe is help me, because I don't have the time to sit down and research and go through all
right.
of it. if you could pull out the key papers, okay, and the things that they've done to show how they just claim abandonment, and whereas, you know, they've have interpreted a foreclosure as abandonment, okay, that would be really helpful, because we can potentially insert that position of what they're doing inside of the amicus curiae.
Yeah, see, they didn't put that on mine yet. But see, my case is even better than
that. Well, you can use an example, or you can show how they progressed on your case to do this.
Right, and see, I have all my, which I sent you is all my documents, where it's all in my name. I said, who's going to sign off my name? You know? And the former judge said, don't worry about it, we'll have that taken care of. Well, that's perjury. Because I have my warranty deed, quick claim deed, life use. Matter of fact, I'm going to put air property on there for 1,000 years. I'm going to do that this week.
Well, you're familiar or aware with the fact that they have no skin in the game, and that the original individuals that claim to be collecting the mortgage really have no skin in the game, so therefore
it's
they have
GE
no...
It's the Federal Credit Union, and they're going under, and I
and
never
they sold
out a contract.
It, right? Didn't they sell yours? Did they package it and sell it?
The Bridgeport Fire Department, they stole the money from me, $250,000.
Yeah, but who did you originally... What entity did you go through to
People
get
Savings
the original?
Bank.
Okay, so that's a whole different entity than GE, right?
Absolutely. They were selling my name, and then
so
it was GHH Mortgage.
And this is always the case with all of them. Maybe we should include it in the paper. You know, they first of all, they didn't have the power or the authority to package it, to monetize it. We cover all that in the paper. But they also... didn't have they didn't have the authority to even collect, because they have no investment of their own. They went to the Fed window to get that money. Okay, that bank didn't come up with money on their own. They didn't make an investment in this in any way, shape, or form. So they have no claim of anything in the way of an investment. And when they sold it, they got two problems. Not only do they not have any claim into it, they also have no agreement with you. And the original participant has no agreement with you either. Your agreement was your signature connected to the Fed window within a 72-hour purchase process.
Right.
And once that money came out, and the money never returns to the Fed, and they really don't care, because it's a game now they're playing with. Matter of fact, the individual we were talking with earlier, talking about the commercial stuff, it's all written up in there. You know, the SESQ accounts, the what are the accounts that is to your name? I forget what they call them. Are they just, it's not the SESQ, is it? I forget. But in any event, they have this requirement that, okay, you know, you have a certain value, and, you know, we're looked at as a good, forget the word I'm looking for here, but chattel. They look at us as chattel, okay? And so they work a value into the game, and the money is given out because there was an agreement in the commercial ends when they wrote this stuff. So the money is given out, so when you go get yourself a mortgage, they never look for the return because it's a value given to you. But... there's a number of things that go on around that. First of all, it's not money you're getting, it's debt that they're giving you. That's another point to be made on this. The other thing is that they make a lot of money or debt, which they turn to gold and silver, and they will turn it all to gold and silver before the collapse comes. But in any event, they have taken they're getting money because they're making money off the banks from another direction here, okay?
That's the MERS. It's called MERS, right. They
conversion? Is that what it's called? Conversion?
It's called MERS, M-E-R-S.
Spell that again. N-E-R-S?
It's called MERS, M, capital E, capital R-S. And that's also where our pension comes from.
Okay,
and
I definitely got to look into
that. There's over 30,000, 40,000 people under the MERS, and that's how they... So anytime when they're changing your mortgage, look on your deed form, and it has MERS. And I said, wait a minute, that's our pension and everything else. And it's a group of people, and it's like all on Wall Street or whatever, how they've been changing and scamming people's names. And then my question to them, who signed my name? I would like to see a sworn notarized affidavit.
Right.
You know, because I was the
well,
one
they tried
originally
to play the game with the
mortgage.
Birth certificate, too, you know.
Well, I got that squared away, too.
Yeah, but again, it's all, look, it's all fraud. And that was the point I was trying to make with the caller before you here. It's all fraud.
Right.
They can't do that. There's no power authority. Look, it's anybody in elected service or appointed service or even just employed service through any part of any government anywhere, okay, they must fall under the United States Constitution, okay? Now, of course, there are state constitutions, and as long as it's not in contradiction and to anything in the United States Constitution, it's fine. Once it violates an unalienable right protected or not, because you've got a lot of more rights than what we've listed in the Ten Amendments, okay? But once they oh goodness, I forget where I was going with this.
Once we can prove the rights.
Well, anyway, the bottom line is that they make this all stuff up. It's all a fraud. Has no power, no authority. It's in contradiction to the Constitution, and therefore it can't go forward. Now, if you there's a couple of ways that people go about this. Number one, they don't understand it and they can't make the argument and they lose on the merit of the case because they could never really define their position, nor did they understand the jurisdiction. They didn't have the ability, the knowledge to deny the jurisdiction, or whether it be subject matter jurisdiction, or which they usually have, but they don't have the personam jurisdiction. So they don't know enough to do those things. The other side of the thing is, you know, there's a saying out there, I forget who it was that said this. I recently saw that the person who originally quote this, and I forget who it was. But it's not what you know that hurts you. I mean, it's not what you don't know that hurts you. It's what you think you know and don't know that gets you, okay? And so therein is the teachings of these websites that are teaching all of this stuff concerning the citizenship stuff and the man on the land thing and all this stuff, which they're not incorrect on. Don't get me wrong. They're not incorrect, but they're getting into the game, okay? And they're going to get hurt in the game because they only allow the players to come into the game. And because you still lack the enough knowledge to not really be able to get through the process, maybe one or two can, but, you know, basically most people can't. They don't have the ability to articulate their case. They don't understand the courts that they're in, the jurisdictions. They don't understand different things and the law itself and how it constructs to get to a certain point and a conclusion. They don't have that knowledge. So they're kind of wandering around in the dark, and they're running off of things that people concluded, and sometimes the conclusions are wrong, sometimes they're right, sometimes it's a mixed thing on that. And so what the courts will do is they'll make an idiot out of you. The lawyers on the other side will come out like a swarm of bees, but they will pick you to death and sting you. That you're a sovereign citizen, you don't believe in any law, nothing applies to you. I mean, they throw all these things out, okay, at you, because you make statements that sets the stage for them to expound upon and exaggerate and bring it way out of proportion. And that's a psychological game, okay? It also fills the courtroom, it fills the court with all kinds of smoke and BS in there, that you got to get down to what the core of the case is about. And that's why I talk about keeping things simple. You got to keep a case simple. Otherwise, it's going to get lost in all kinds of junk. But, again, you know, I got
some important stuff, but I'm forgetting. I got to speak on this. Okay. First of all, because I did this work, so I, you know, and they know I've been going into court. I've never had no attorney. I've been representing myself. And a lot of stuff I started learning, you know, and doing my homework, like, number one, from day one, am I a public servant of this court? Is this my grand jury, you know? And he said, no, I'm the grand jury. I said, you just committed treason. I asked for his resignation. First time he told me to get the hell out of his court, you know. And I said, oh, okay. And as we went on, the subrogation, the due process, no proof of claim. And then I remember I'm the one who did my own contract when I bought my house. So I said, well, who signed my name? And I remember one thing when my husband working in there. You can't change somebody's mortgage or anything without them signing. That's number one.
That's
Show
right.
me proof of claim. Give me the affidavit. So you know what I'm saying. Now I'm pinning them to the corner. So a lot of those attorneys that were in there, they knew I knew my stuff because I'm the one who trained a lot of them, you know?
And
so,
don't forget the fiduciary authority.
The fiduciary.
Because
mm-hmm. I got a probate hearing next week. And this mm-hmm. person just scammed and stole a family member's the whole estate and lied, had them buried and all. So it's a lot of mess. But what I did do, I was contacting our Congress and Attorney General, this and that. So I started following, keeping through the paper trail. I also filed a grievance on these attorneys and judges, right? And what happened, the Bar Association, the Grievance Committee, they found them all not at fault, all right? And they dismissed it. So then when I started sending them different paperwork, and I asked them for their juris number, come to find out they're all attorneys. In our state, mm-hmm. we got 33,000 attorneys. Oh, really? So now what I did, I was going through my paperwork and the consumer protection for our state, all right? I found a letter from them stating that they found no fault, in other words, with the GE Federal Credit Union, and everything seemed okay. Well,
of course, they're lawyers, yeah.
Wait a second. So guess what I did? So I said, oh, my God. And it just what happened the day I was going through this stuff. I found that letter, and I turned around, and I amended that 1938 Foreign Agent Act, also that IR code, 6065, and I sent it to them. So now I get a call. And they said, you sent us the wrong papers. This is not us. I said, oh, no, this is you. It came from your department, from this number, and this is the person who signed off. She goes, well, no, you don't send that back to us. I said, no. As a matter of fact, I said, the attorneys, I said, this is from the Consumer Department from the state of Connecticut. I said, oh, by the way, can I please speak to Mr. State of Connecticut, the Consumer Protection? Well, I said, is there an attorney? Well, the attorneys, they don't represent the people there. They're here to represent us. Well, they're the ones who gave the ruling. So can I please speak to Mr. State of Connecticut, the consumer, because you did respond, and I got your head in right here.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get back to you. I haven't heard nothing else. You know, but...
Well, yeah, you know, these people can't answer any of these things, and we know they
can't.
And again, you know, you need to move this into federal court. We'll write a paper, you know, with you for you on the amicus curiae, and... I'd like to get in there some information, a little detail, on...
And see the federal court, right, and see, with the federal court, they're the ones who said that I was a serial...
Yeah, they want to get rid of you. And look, the problem is you're not coming in the way they want you to come in. They're not coming in, you're not coming in with their procedures per se. You probably didn't write your papers right and so on and so forth, and they just want to get rid of you. And the other thing is that we have to try to find a way to come in on this into the court to open up the concealed court, which is the court of justice. And we're working on that. That's what we're working on.
And it's not an easy task,
I'll tell you that.
Okay, they also sent me all my paperwork back again. Now, when I went there and I said, I would like this to be, I want this to be my files are stamped. And they go, we have to cross it out. No, that's crossing your tampering with evidence. This is, his face turned as red as a beet. I said, by the way, I've been filing all kinds of paperwork So I know you have all my evidence still here, okay? Which on my other case, I found out they shredded my medical records, the city records, all that stuff. Oh, really? And you can't tamper with any evidence when you've got a case going on, you know?
All right, well, look, this is what you need to do. I'd like to get the information concerning the game that they play here with, you know, changing, saying that the property has been abandoned. So if you can write something very simple, put it together, you know, kind of, you know, the process that they go through. And if you have any documents to go along with it, that's good. We're not going to use your documents in any cases or anything, but
right.
It's just helpful to look at and see.
Well,
and,
you know, can I finish saying this? What I was thinking about it, and I was thinking and praying, what I'm going to do, along with you, which you're telling me, I want to address, I am not going to abandon my property. You are foreclosing, and I am not abandoning my property. Here is my proof of claim, and my property is paid off. You know, I definitely, and this is, I want to do a sworn affidavit on
that.
Well,
you know what, that's a good idea. Give them a sworn statement on your proof of claim and your proof of fiduciary authority, and put it into the court, and let it be known that you have no intentions, also inside these affidavits, that you have no intentions of abandoning your property, and that you intend in all, you know, your intention is totally to have this until you depart from this world, and you pass it on to one of your family members,
the heir,
you know, your children, whatever.
And we also...
Sure, that's an idea of way to go with this. I never thought about that. Give them fiduciary authority and proof of claim.
Okay, that's what I was going to run that by you. Also,
well, you know what you do. You know what
wait
you
a second,
do.
Let me finish before I forget, because December 6th...
Right, you know me too. I forget too.
I know. All right, December 6th in Connecticut,
too much fluoride,
they're having a rally up here at the Capitol about these courts here and the illegal foreclosures, the falsely imprisonment. And I told everybody, well, contact your – everything we do, you make sure you contact the attorney general, you contact the congressmen, the senators and all that, because most of them are all attorneys. So they can't say they didn't know. Okay?
Right.
And I think if we sit there and make sure, well, yeah, we did notify you on this. Everybody needs to contact all the people all around the country on their politicians. Now they're backpedaling. Okay, that's what I want to. But it's December 6th.
Well, look, in order to write this paper for your own fiduciary authority, showing it and also the proof of claim, go out, and you may already have this because I've mentioned this numerous times. Go out and Google Form 56 or Form 4490. One of them is proof of claim. The other one is fiduciary authority. It's federal. And take that form and create your own form. Now, what you want to do in creating your own form is you're creating an affidavit form, okay? But you do want to make the point of what this form is all about. It's about fiduciary authority, and the other one is about proof of claim. Kind of work off the, you know, forms are put together and they're put out there so we have uniformity. And people can cover all the bases necessary because there's check boxes and this and that, whatever it is that's covered
right, so
in
that's
this. 456. No, form, F-O-R-M, 56.
Yes.
And the other one is Form, F-O-R-M, 4490. Put it in Google, it'll pop right up, both of them forms.
4490.
And and from there, you know, you can springboard your own form, make it unique to yourself, put in your own details, your own stuff, make it affidavit form, make it clear that this is an affidavit proving or showing, you know, affidavit concerning fiduciary authority over the property. This is an affidavit, proof of claim over the property, and so on.
Okay?
And file that in the court. It'd be interesting to see what they do with that. Then you file with that. With those filings, you make it clear that the court has no...
jurisdiction, no proof.
No, but there's another thing I want... What was it? There's no... credible documentation within this court concerning fiduciary authority or proof of claim And here is mine. I'm now placing it into the court. Now the court needs to deal with that. Now an affidavit unrebutted stands as truth in a court. Let them rebut it. And if they don't rebut it, and they continue to move forward, and they go past the 30 days, and again, you should write your paper up in a way.
I need help.
I'm trying to think on how you would go about doing it, because you can't really do a motion per se. You could do, I don't know if maybe Brent has an idea with this, but somehow, your point is this. You want to cause the other side to respond, okay? You want to write something up in such a way that the other side needs to respond and that it's obvious that you're looking for their response to this. And their lack of response becomes a default, and then you can file an affidavit of default 30 days out. Okay?
Well, that's what I did, right. That's what I, you know, okay, I can. And that's why they respond and send the paperwork back. And one thing they keep on doing, criminal, they keep, after they stamp it and they put it in my files, they cross it out and send it back. You can't do that. And when he tried to do it in front of me, said, you cannot cross anything out. You can add to it, but you can't take away from.
Right.
Okay.
Well, any of your papers that you file, try to file them personally if you can. Bring a notice and demand. Get your stamped copies. Let them do whatever they please with it at that point, because then you go after them for mutilation, concealment, or whatever else, removal, and so on. You know, and again, you use their own codes against them. They were written for you to control you. This is your policies, your procedures. These codes require your obedience, not mine. You violated them, and it calls for this this kind of a situation should you, do this. You know, you're going to get a year in jail or whatever, a fine, blah, 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 blah. You know, this is that they wrote it up, you know. Congress wrote it up, so utilize it, exercise it. But whenever you exercise any of these codes, you have to be careful somewhere in the paperwork to make it clear that that this is really applied to them. It's their policies or their regulations, their codes, not mine. I'm not held to codes, but they are. And then you can bring up codes and hold their feet to the fire on them.
Okay, they are held to their codes.
But I got to move on. And
okay, thank you. I'll be in touch.
We should have a meeting. First of all, get that little thing going that I said, as far as kind of write up something very simple and sort of just a guideline process, you know, of it. And if you ever want to attach any documents that might be advantageous for me to look at, to see, and then maybe I can take that and incorporate that position inside the amicus curiae that we've already got most of it written up for the non-judicial foreclosure. It's just a matter of dressing it in a different way, you know, dressing it underneath the amicus curiae. And then maybe add this new stuff into it, and then also not the threat, but the promise of bringing this before the full grand jury for indictment, because what you're doing is a crime. Fix it in this courtroom, make it right, or pay the price. And we do file our indictments not only in the federal court and in the Northern District, but we also file it with the Attorney General's office, and we file it with the President. And so, you know, it's in many places, also with the judiciary committees on both state and on the Senate and the Congress. So, you know, it's filed in a lot of places. And when the time comes for justice, you know, look at Trump is up there beating the drum, talking about the people in America, the people are sovereign, okay? I was not elected to get more power, but to return power back to the people. Okay, he understands what we're doing. He's been watching what we're doing. He doesn't communicate directly with us, but we know that he knows. We listen to what he's saying, and we wonder sometimes, I wonder if they got that from us, because I ain't never heard anyone talk about the common law and connect it with natural law to make sure it's clear what kind of common law they're talking about. It, but his administration does. They talk like that. And they understand, and they understand that the people have to take control. I want to return power back to the people. Well, where do you return power? There's only two places, political and judicial. If we have political power and judicial power, and how do you have judicial power? You control through the juries, unadulterated from any judge or any prosecutor, totally separated from them, okay? And where do you get the political? From the committeeman process, requiring statesmen instead of politicians, okay? And that's where you get it. That's where the people get the power.
Well,
and
that's
one of the things we're trying to communicate to the president so he understands that, you know,
well,
he should at some point support us, get behind us.
Right. But that's why I said send it to all of our congresspeople so they can't send it in now.
Right.
And so that's perfectly timely.
Make sure you certify it so you know that they got it. But let me move on because we only got a little time and I got another caller in the queue. So, but get a hold of Jan to set up something with me when you can.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to, let's see, who's the next one? Someone from Georgia? Next question. Go ahead. 770.
Yeah. So I have a question for the gentleman that was just talking. Was he referencing the foreign agent registration statement and the anti-bribery statement that he made requests for? And it sounded like he got some proof showing that they had no jurisdiction, so I wanted clarification on that. And then the other thing is, as it pertains to the challenge on jurisdiction, apart from the questions
that
you
asked. Before you go any further, let me unmute Crystal, because I think that's who you were talking about. Crystal?
Oh, okay.
Do you understand the question that she's asking? I think she's still here. I just unmuted her.
She may have.
Maybe we lost her. Okay, because I can't answer that question for her.
Okay.
But anyway, if she's still here, she's unmuted. If she comes back to a mic, well, all she has to do is speak. She's unmuted. But go ahead. What's your other thing?
And then the other question was with regard both on the question she was asking and the prior caller with regard to the challenge on jurisdiction. Are there any particular questions, or what do they have to produce to prove jurisdiction, like in this traffic matter, infraction?
Right. Well, look at all courts must have the jurisdiction on the paperwork. So you can request that. There's Supreme Court rulings concerning that. I'm sure we can find some. But jurisdiction must be on the paperwork. And that's where they have a problem, because is this a civil case or is it a criminal case? Well, you know, I've heard that argument or that idea of making that argument, but I never heard it really clearly, clarified what really is happening here. You see, if it's a civil case, it's statutory, has nothing to do with us. If it's a criminal case, it's statutory, has nothing to do with us, okay? Both criminal cases and civil cases are courts of equity and decided in courts of equity. Now, sometimes the judge may permit, isn't that nice, a group of people and he'll call them a jury, okay? But they're going to do his will because he's going to tell them what his will is and they're going to do it. And if not, he'll overrule the jury and does all kinds of things. This is not a court of record. This is not a court of justice, a court of law. This is not a court where the people decide. This is a court where this, political individual decides. Okay, and so that's the problem is discovering the jurisdiction. You know, and there are Supreme Court rulings that make it clear that both civil courts and criminal courts are equity courts. They're statutory. It has nothing to do with the common law. They're not courts of record. They can't be called a court of record. What is very interesting, though, is the most destructive of all of them that calls themselves a court of record, and the only one that calls himself a court of record inside the title itself is USC 26. And they call themselves a court of record. I find that very interesting and also very dangerous. I don't know if you're familiar with Bill Thornton. Bill Thornton has these ideas and theories concerning this kind of thing. And, he makes a statement, well, they're going to court of record. Let's make the claim on it. I disagree with that position. I take a different choice on that. I want to know what the jurisdiction is, challenge jurisdiction, and move it back into the federal court. Well, you're in the federal court. No, we're in a tax court. If you're operating under USC 26, you're calling yourself an Article I court that doesn't exist in the first place. No power or authority given for that such a court. You're calling yourself a tax court. Again, no authority given for that. You know, what's very strange is they enacted it into law. The same day they enacted it into law, they took it out of law. Isn't that very strange that they did that? So they'll refer back to the enactment, okay, which is still written in the paperwork, but unless you look at the table where it says it's been removed, it's been, I forget the word, but it's no longer law, you know, but they'll play the game. And there's a lot of stuff in there you can use, but why fight the battle there? What's the jurisdiction? Put the jurisdiction up on the papers. It'd be interesting to find what kind of jurisdiction they try to claim. But here's the key, mm-hmm. and then I'll listen to the rest of what you have to say. Here's the key, though. Okay. Any court that operates under statute is not a court of record. Any court that operates with statutes are equity courts, and therefore they're not courts of justice. They are also referred to as what's called nisi prius courts. They do not have the power or the authority to fine or incarcerate. Although, under certain titles, if you go into the USC titles that have been enacted into law, okay, where there are penalties, like in USC 18, it's maritime law. They do have the power and the authority to act there. But if the person, I don't know how this works at this point, because everybody has a right to be judged by their peers. So you can request the jury. But here now you have a jury that comes in that's going to be, the judge does have the right here now to inform the court of the law, that the law requires this penalty or that penalty. Now, the jury also must understand at the same point that we have the power of nullifying that, okay? So you see there's both positions are acceptable in that court under that jurisdiction, which is maritime. And again, I don't have much knowledge there, but just logic, and from what I've read and understand, that would be my thinking of that. And they have transformed that over into, they call it a court of record, or they call it a place where you can get your common law. They refer to it as a criminal court or a civil court. And now the judge applies his rule and thoughts and ideas on the court. And he doesn't have the power or the authority to do that. That's tainting the jury is what that is. But on top of that, okay, he also denies the power and the unalienable right of that jury, the people of that jury, to say no, nullify. We disagree. We don't think anyone should go to jail for 20 years for that. We think they should go to jail for 1 year, maybe, I don't know, whatever they want to think or do or say. Restitution is always the key, though. The jury should always have an eye on restitution, not incarceration, restitution. And if a person's going to run, you could put a ring on them and keep them under house arrest. They can watch their comings and goings. But they can be out there in society doing the things they have to do in order to get up the necessary, payment of restitution towards the injured party. That's justice. If you steal a man's ox, you got to give him back three. You may only have two.
Four.
Well, you're going to have to go earn some money to buy another one so you can give that third one back. Okay? You see, that's the principle of common law.
So but in this case where it's an infraction or traffic matter, criminal, the jurisdiction was challenged.
A criminal traffic matter. That's big.
Criminal only because, like, they included the resisting officer in it, but it's just infractions, traffic. It's just infractions. So the judge said that jurisdiction didn't matter. And before he said that, he stated that jurisdiction could be challenged at any time.
What's the infraction?
It was no driver's license and alleged crossing yellow line, which they changed to unsafe lane change, which they are putting it on a North expired North Carolina license, and I have a Georgia driver's license, which they know is active and valid, and they have known.
Okay,
all
so you
them.
Had a driver's license, you know, now you fall under, you know, you fall under the acknowledgement from one state to another. What was that, Article 5 or 6? I think it was Article 6 we were looking at, and he's refusing to acknowledge these things. What's the maximum penalty on this that you face?
The to be honest with you, I think the fine is only like $20. It's less than $50.
Okay, and what about incarceration? Are they threatening you with that?
Well, they have threatened that on the resisting officer, but they have falsely incarcerated me over this already.
Here's what I would do if I were you, okay? Anytime there's a threat of incarceration, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Anytime there's a threat of
that and the psyche vow.
Right, and that too, okay? Anytime
mm-hmm.
there's a threat of those things, if you can deal with them and pay them the money to get out of there, do it. If you want to go back after them, then you go back and you take them into court yourself. You take them into the state court. Now, of course, there is a problem there, too, you know, because they're going to stick up for each other to some degree and becomes a chess game between you and the judge and so on and so forth, and he's going to want to throw you out real quick and, you know, failure to state a claim or some BS, something like that. So you got to be careful with all that, but then you can move it into the federal court. They'll try to do the same thing, remember. And again, it really stinks that you can't get justice here in anywhere, in any of these courts. But we're working on a way to do this, hopefully, and hopefully we'll be successful and people can, you know, copy that and find a way to get into a court where it's untouched by a political animal, you know, like a judge.
Well, the judge, I didn't understand his well, he said that it had nothing to do with jurisdiction. And so I just made the comment that any time jurisdiction was challenged, it must
be proven on the
in
record.
Writing. Correct. In writing.
Well, I would never, I'll give you some experience. I've been involved with cases that gone on for over a year, just over jurisdiction. I mean, they don't know what to do. They get frustrated. You keep telling them to come back another date. They're trying to figure out what to do, blah, blah. Eventually, you know, they start to get dangerous on you. But look, you don't ever challenge jurisdiction in the sense of asking them to prove it. You deny them jurisdiction because they don't have it. Okay? You tell them they don't have it. And also demand whatever jurisdiction this court does have, can you please have it put on the papers, because that's the law. These courts have got to put, and then none of them do it. None of them do it. First thing I do when opening up a case, up where you put the judge's name or the magistrate's name. I use just magistrate, traffic cop, and you know, and the court number and maybe a title for the paper possibly. But on the very top, all the way on the very top, I put down the jurisdiction, semicolon, or is it colon? Yeah, colon. Jurisdiction, colon, court of record. And then I put a footnote on what that means and identify it not only directly to the common law, but the meaning of the common law is natural law. And then that's what I put on every paper that I file. Now, I've already established the jurisdiction. They'll try changing it, okay? And there's games they play to have it changed. And matter of fact, you're good to make record on the court as you move forward. On and for the record, I want it to be established. We're still in a court of record that I have filed or whatever the case may be. You want to keep it in the jurisdiction you belong in. A court of record is a court of justice. It's not criminal. It's not civil. It's a combination of both. And it operates under natural law, common law. And the people, if it's a criminal matter, the people have to indict, unadulterated. And if it is a civil matter, in either case, they both have juries. You can come to an agreement between the parties as the case progresses, and if the judge is honest, he should push the case towards that and say, hey, look, you know, I think there's enough on the paper. You guys should go in the back room and talk about this, settle this matter. Try to settle it without having to go through the whole process. Otherwise, it's going to go, if it's a court of record, it's got to go before a jury.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can choose, in civil matters, you can choose equity court. But who would choose equity court in today's environment? I mean, these people are all criminals. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, yeah, okay. I would get out of there and ensue them. If you try to fight, you're putting your energies into that court to win there, you're not going to win. Okay.
No,
the only thing
I've tried to remove it to federal court. Someone told me to consider maybe doing a writ of mandamus.
Yeah, they're going to ignore the writ of mandamus, number one. Moving into federal court is very, very, you got to be very careful on how you word it. You have to be very clear. It's got to be a constitutional violation. It's got to be clearly stated. Okay? And then, depending on the case, if the judge feels pressured to maintain the status quo, they're going to work together. The lawyer on the other, they're working, you know, the prosecutor, who will continue to take the case on, probably, or the attorney general might take the case on, someone from that office. But the bottom line is they're gonna work you over. The judge and that lawyer is gonna work you over, and they're gonna move through the Rule 12 thing to have you thrown out, and the judge is gonna amplify on his paperwork and his decision. All the things that will try to damage you or whatever to conclude that you're thrown out for violating some rule in 12, usually failure to state a claim or something. It's just an endless game. It gets depressing and tiring after a while.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
But these people need to go to jail. That's where they need to be.
I agree.
At some point,
the
line is being drawn, and they're going to have to come on the right side of the line, or they're going to end up in jail.
I guess that was part of the concern that I have. The extent that they've gone to, how do you effectively hold them accountable for?
You're not
going to
do it inside that courtroom.
Yeah. Okay. So
they're only going to pile more and more on you. Look, they talk about the psychological. Now they're going to try to take control of your body, your person. Look at this. You know, it's a dangerous thing, you know, that you're getting involved in here. I tell people, yeah, the traffic court is a good place to try to learn something and do something, but I do it by paper. I'd only write one paper, follow with the court. It either works or it doesn't. If it doesn't work, I'm just going to bail out real quick, pay the fine, and move on. Maybe I'll go back and sue them later. I put it in a file with other traffic cases. But generally speaking, it's just not worth the battle and the loss of your freedom and them violating you and maybe even trying to incarcerate you because they say you're crazy and because that's what they're trying to do. That's why they want a psych eval because they want to say, this guy's crazy, this woman's crazy. You know, we're not going to, you know, this is their game. And besides that, they got to beat you up as best you can so nobody else does it, number one. And by the way, they're so arrogant. Their opinion is, how dare you think you can come into this court and make these claims and try to do this or that? I mean, that's how bad it is. It's arrogance. Mm-hmm. There's no justice in any of those courts. They're not. Mm-hmm. Those courts were not built on justice anyway. They were built on criminal activities because it's all about, you know, extorting the people. You know, that's all it's about.
Now, if somebody writes an order and they put the name of, they put a name like Charles Henry, but that was not the name of the judge or it's not even the name of a judge that you know of at that court, what is that called?
Don't know what that might be. I don't know. Fraud is what I'd call it.
Okay.
So, all right, but anyway, we've reached the end of our time. You got a final statement before we close down?
No, I think that, well, I guess one last thing. So if they force you to come to court, can you go just on paper?
Well, I never go to court. I file the paper. That's all I do. I appear on paper, period. make that point. Here's my appearance on this case on paper. I make my statement, and ultimately I'm telling them they need to dismiss the case and make my positions. And again, you know, a couple of things happen. And, you know, either you never hear from that court again, and I'm a happy camper with that, or sometimes they'll send you papers back, and or they'll continue to push forward with calling for a hearing and so on. At that point, I'm settling and I'm out of there because it's just not, I don't have the time, and I don't want to fall into the danger pit there. You know, you walk into that courtroom that at that point and just say, okay, I'll pay the fine. They're not going to give you a hard time anymore. You see, they won, and that's that. That's how they feel, and they feel good about themselves. Then you could sue them.
Yeah. So even in a case where, say, like the ADA has already, like they charged me a separate time from that same charge, and they've already dismissed the charge.
I'm sorry. Who does the ABA?
Yeah, the Assistant District Attorney. Mm-hmm. She's already dismissed the charge before.
Oh, ADA. Okay.
Mm-hmm. AD.
Yeah. Well, look, they contradict themselves all the time. If they done it on paper, make the point.
Okay.
You know, bring the paper in that they discharged or whatever, and make the point. How can you come back and redo this?
Okay.
And you know, to be a wise guy in the court, where's the indictment? I haven't been charged by a jury of my peers with some infraction somehow, you know. And they'll try to say, well, this is not a criminal case. Well, what is it then? You know, they may say traffic, but they try to stay away from that. I think they get confused, to be honest. They don't know what to call it.
Yeah, well, one judge already said it was no crime. So that in of itself, I think, says it. There's no crime. There's no case, right. I don't think.
Well, that's true, but now holding him to his word, they love to contradict themselves, you know?
Yeah.
So. All right, well, anyway.
All right, well, thank
appreciate
you.
Appreciate the call, thank you. And all right, we're going to close down now. Lord willing, we'll be back next Monday. And by the way, coming up next month, Christmas, I think Christmas falls on a Monday, doesn't it? Let me see. Hang on, as a matter of fact, I think it falls on a Tuesday. Well, let me find out. Just to give heads up. Yeah, it falls on a Tuesday. So Christmas Eve is the 24th. Just to let everybody know ahead of time, it's a few weeks away. It's 3-4 weeks away yet. 4 weeks, I think. We will not be having an open forum on that Monday, the 24th. And we may not have one on January for New Year's Eve either. We'll make that decision a little later, but probably not. But anyway, Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Thanks for coming, everyone. Good night.